You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Is there something happening here? Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
At this point, when you look at some of the oligarchs themselves, I don't think money is necessarily the driving factor behind this. I think that we have to start to understand that this is ultimately about control, control of society, control of the very genetic code of the planet itself. And that might sound outlandish until you start to piece all of these different pieces of the puzzle together. Control over education, control over medicine, control over plants and agriculture start to form a control grid, which really does look like a monopolization of almost every aspect of life as we know it.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, James Corbett. Today's show, oil and 9/11, crossroads of corruption and criminality. James Corbett is the producer and host of The Corbett Report, an internet-based, independent, listener-supported alternative news source that has attracted a large audience. The Corbett Report is edited, webmastered, written, produced, and hosted by James Corbett. It includes a weekly podcast and several regular online video series. James Corbett has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started The Corbett Report website in 2007 as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. Today we discuss in detail 2-hour-long video documentaries written and produced by James Corbett, How Big Oil Conquered the World and 9/11 Trillions Follow the Money. James Corbett, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me here. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, it's nice to meet you finally, James. I'd like to talk to you today about your 2 video documentaries, How Big Oil Conquered the World and 9/11 Trillions Follow the Money. Your recent documentary, How Big Oil Conquered the World, was also called Rise of the Oligarchy. You produced it in 4 parts, The Birth of the Oligarchy, Competition is a Sin, The World in Their Image, and Monopolizing Life. You cover a breathtaking amount of complex historical events in the space of an hour and 15 minutes. And, of course, the documentary raises as many questions as it answers. Naturally, you start with the Rockefellers and move forward from there. What's an oligarchy, and why did you name it this?
I think oligarchy is the best way to try to encapsulate what really developed with the creation of the oil industry as we know it. And that, of course, dates back to the 19th century and parts of the early 20th century, but it didn't take very long for the oil industry to become monopolized. It became not just a commodity that was handled by monopoly cartels, perhaps best exemplified by the Standard Oil cartel, but that it became the backbone for the economy and for really the entire production of world goods altogether, not only in terms of the energy that's required to produce and ship goods around the world, but even the goods themselves are often made out of petrochemical and basically their derivative products. So I thought it was important to try to understand that and the importance of that the modern oligarchy as it exists over the global economic system is in many ways an oligarchy. It is founded and run by the same family cartels that managed to monopolize the oil industry in its early parts. But I also wanted to make the point that it isn't really just the oil industry itself that is the range of influence or activity of these oligarchical interests, that over the course of the 20th century, they started to branch out into a lot of very diverse fields and used the economic control that came with the monopolization of the oil industry for other ends.
In part 2, Competition is a Sin, you cover a dizzying array of subjects, from ethanol, prohibition, the destruction of mass transit, the rise of OPEC, the elimination of the gold standard, petrodollars, etc.
With regard to the so-called oil embargo of 1973, you talk about the Yom Kippur War as being orchestrated to ultimately usher in higher oil prices. I remember the 1973 oil shock, and I also remember seeing the Shah of Iran on 60 Minutes, I think it was, saying that oil tankers were leaving Iran as usual. There were also claims that these tankers were simply not being unloaded. The whole thing was fake, don't you think?
Well, yes, and I think it's important to understand where the fakeness of that event really stems from. And in the documentary, I present some of the documents that have since come to light of the 1973 meeting of the Bilderberg Group, a very elite organization that has largely remained under the media radar for many decades. It was founded in 1954 by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who himself, of course, is reputed to be one of the major stakeholders in Shell Oil, Royal Dutch Shell, that should be. And so in 1973, this Bilderberg meeting specifically was talking about the possibility of an oil crisis, a large increase in energy costs that they were talking about could be as much as a $10 to $12 increase in the price per barrel, which at that time was a 400% increase over regular prices. Now, it's interesting to note when this meeting convened in May of 1973, there was no oil embargo at that time. There was not even really the hint of one because the Yom Kippur War had not even taken place at that point. This was all theoretical that they were supposedly discussing in these leaked documents. But lo and behold, in October of that year, of course, OPEC did decide to raise oil prices, first by 70%, and then in December, the Shah of Iran, as you mentioned, demanded a 400% oil price increase at the December meeting of OPEC, and that was granted. So by the end of the year, the Bilderberg meeting that in May, again, had been calling for a 400% price increase, saw that 400% price increase materialize. And I think most interestingly, the Saudi King Faisal's personal emissary had been asked at one point by a journalist why the 400% increase was necessary, and had been told by the Shah, "Tell your king if he wants the answer to this question, he should go to Washington and ask Henry Kissinger," which is extremely interesting in light of recently declassified documents from the Israeli archives that were declassified in 2013 and reported on by the LA Times and other outlets at that time, that Henry Kissinger had had a back-channel negotiation, a secret back-channel negotiation ongoing with Golda Meir in the run-up to the Yom Kippur War, in which Meir and Kissinger, by association, had rejected numerous different peace offerings by Sadat. And basically, the war had been, if not necessarily the invasion orders signed by Henry Kissinger, at any rate, he had been complicit in the push towards that war. So that, of course, the war takes place, and then the OPEC embargo takes place as a result of that. So it does seem that we do have good, solid documentary evidence that this war was engineered, at the very least allowed to happen, or pushed into a position where it would happen, so that the OPEC oil price increase would happen. And again, we have the Saudi king's personal emissary saying that Kissinger was really responsible for the Iranian demand for the oil price increase.
Well, yeah, James, it sounds like everybody was in on it, including OPEC.
Well, exactly. Well, certain members of OPEC anyway. And of course, it did work out extremely well for certain members of the oil cartel in various parts of the world, including Saudi Arabia, who, as the other shoe of to drop in this changeover that took place in that period of time, became a beneficiary of the American military umbrella as part of the petrodollar system that was also engineered with the help of course, Henry Kissinger, who basically provided military protection as well as arms sales to Saudi Arabia in return for the Saudis agreeing to price all of their future oil sales in U.S. dollars, thus creating a demand for U.S. dollars in an environment where there was not necessarily anything really at all backing up the U.S. dollar anymore, since Kissinger had taken the dollar off of the gold standard in 1971. So if the Saudis and others, who would obviously follow them in this move, priced their oil in U.S. dollars, that would create that ready-made demand. And, of course, also the Saudis agreed to funnel that money back into the U.S. through the Wall Street banks by buying up U.S. treasuries. So it was a really masterful political and economic move that helped to not only consolidate the control of really the oligarchs, because, of course, this is oil interests that are now backing up the U.S. dollar and thus the world monetary system as a whole, but also, of course, for the very few elite-connected individuals and parties that get to take advantage of that new paradigm.
Well, yes, exactly. And all of these things, the going off the gold standard, the creation of the petrodollars, et cetera, this all served to preserve the dollar as the global reserve currency, right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah, because I remember from your documentary, and of course, well, it's well known, that around the time that Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard, there was an economic crisis that caused that, right?
Well, there was a number of reasons for it, and I think it was pretty inevitable by the point that Nixon actually formally took the dollar off the gold standard in 1971. It was almost inevitable that was going to happen. There were a number of reasons for it, but really throughout the 1960s, the Bretton Woods system that had been put in place in the wake of World War II. Bretton Woods conference took place, of course, in New Hampshire in 1944 to form the basis of the post-World War II economy. And at that point, it was agreed that basically the currencies of many different countries would be pegged to the U.S. dollar, which itself would be redeemable for gold at the rate of $35 an ounce. But in order to maintain that peg, there, of course, had to be a somewhat steady and predictable increase in the supply of U.S. dollars at a reasonable rate. But as we can see, of course, with the Vietnam War, there was just increase in spending to a degree that was worrying a lot of people. And so you started to get countries like Germany and France starting to demand actual gold for their dollars. And the U.S. Federal Reserve was running out of gold reserves in order to actually backstop that. So in 1971, Nixon did end that system formally. And at that time, it really did create a system where you had this structure where all of these different currencies were more or less either pegged or working in concert with the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency. But there was really nothing at all behind it at that point. So there had to be something to backstop that. And ultimately, it became the oil petrochemical industry that ended up backstopping it really at the barrel of the U.S. Military gun as encapsulated in that deal with Saudi Arabia.
Right. And of course, as I mentioned before, leading up to this point in your documentary, you go through a lot of the early history of oil monopolies, the elimination of ethanol as a fuel, actually prohibition adding to the popularity of oil, the destruction of mass transit. We all know about the electric cars. They were eliminated, et cetera, et cetera. And then in part three, The World in Their Image, you cover control of modern education, medicine, the monetary system, and the food supply. You begin with modern education. What was the Rockefeller plan for modern education, and how did it differ from traditional education?
Well, traditional education in the United States specifically, until the 1850s, there were no compulsory schooling laws. So education tended to be done locally and really in what would be seen from today's point of view as a disorganized way, but in fact led to remarkable successes in terms of having an educated and literate population. In fact, the 1840 census found that that literacy in the U.S. was upwards of 92% to 100%, which shouldn't be surprising because, of course, if you go back to revolutionary times, common sense was a remarkably popular pamphlet that really did start to turn the tide of American public opinion towards the revolutionary bent that it took and saw through to the conclusion of the creation of the country. So I think it was well known that the American populace was extremely well educated before there was compulsory schooling.
I'm speaking with writer and producer James Corbett. Today's show, Oil and 9/11, Crossroads of Corruption and Criminality. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
But with the creation of the modern schooling system and really the Prussian education system, which was adopted largely in the late 19th century, early 20th century in America and elsewhere around the world, as John Taylor Gatto and other researchers have detailed, you started to have the possibility of the curriculum being standardized in a way that would create a predictable outcome for students. And that predictable outcome isn't really difficult to understand what it was or why it would be desired by people in industries of various sorts. Basically, they wanted not independent thinkers who were capable of thinking and acting for themselves, but really people who were educated enough to understand what was needed of them, but basically to consign themselves to a life of labor in a factory, which, of course, was the predominant industrial system of the time. And we don't have to speculate about this. We have this on the record from, for example, Frederick Taylor Gates, who was appointed by Rockefeller to lead the John D. Rockefeller created General Education Board, which was Rockefeller's first major act of philanthropy, endowed with $180 million in 1902, a staggering sum of money at that time. And in a tract written in the early 1900s, Frederick Taylor Gates wrote that he said, "In our dream, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hand. The present educational conventions fade from our minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or science. We are not to raise up from among them authors, orators, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for embryo great artists, painters, musicians, nor will we cherish even the humbler ambition to raise up from among them lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of whom we now have ample supply." Ultimately, of course, what are they trying to raise up then? It is docile workers for the factories of these industrial monopolists. And they were remarkably successful, I think, in that endeavor, if you start to look at the educational outcomes of the rest of the century. But it's not only Rockefeller, but Rockefeller and the Carnegie Endowment worked together in the early part of the 20th century to shape the historical understanding, first in American history, and then through a number of scholarships and the creation of various educational institutions and societies, really started to shape the way that history and education was taught in the United States generally. And another aspect of that was, of course, the Flexner Report, which was released in 1910, that was an overview of the American medical education system at that time that brought about a revolution in the American medical system, which was the next sort of phase of scope of what the oligarchs were looking to try to transform.
Well, that's right. Could you explain the petrochemical interests behind modern medicine? How does modern medicine differ from medicine in the past, and what does it have to do with petrochemicals?
Well, there are different paradigms for understanding what medicine is or how it functions. And in the late 19th century, the battle lines, or if not battle lines, at least the demarcation lines had been drawn between homeopathy, naturopathy, which looked at natural herbs and other ways of trying to stimulate one's own immune response, versus the allopathy, which of course is trying to cut and burn or try to get rid of diseases in various ways. And in the late 19th century, there was an old phrase that basically one way you'll die of the cure, the other way you'll die of the disease, talking about the pretty poor results of medicine at that time. Basically, some of the grotesque types of surgeries that were done without anesthesia or other types of ways of relieving pain were excruciating and caused a lot of early deaths themselves. On the other hand, a lot of naturopaths and homeopaths didn't really have ways of dealing with a lot of illnesses. So there was this sort of uneasy tension, and there was really no regulation by the end of the late 19th century in terms of the medical industry. There was no formalized, standardized system for education, let alone the American Medical Association was only just being birthed. So there was a very scattershot approach to medicine in the early days. But that, of course, was overtaken by the creation of the American Medical Association and the Flexner Report, which, as I say, had a huge impact. It was a Carnegie-sponsored report by someone who went on to work for the Rockefeller Institute, looking at the American medical education system and how it was sloppy and how it should be standardized. And, of course, one of the ways that it ultimately became standardized was to make it a rigorous 7-year training process or more, in which doctors were trained in the use of medicines, which, conveniently enough for the oligarchs, tended to be petrochemically derived medicines. And one, I think, particularly interesting example of that, which I point out in the documentary, is Nujol, which is short for new oil, which was the name of what was marketed as a laxative. It was literally just a crude oil byproduct that was marketed by a Standard Oil subsidiary that also produced pesticides at the same location, the same factory, incidentally, that was marketed as a laxative that would cost something like 10 to 29 cents for a 6-ounce bottle. It cost a Standard Oil less than half a cent to actually create that bottle, but led to quite a lot of profit, obviously. Those are the types of direct monetary interests that the petrochemical manufacturers had in the creation of our modern conception of medicine, to the point where today medicine is synonymous with, of course, the idea of going to a doctor and getting a prescription for a medicine, usually, again, a petrochemically derived medicine, as a way of trying to cope with illness, rather than, of course, looking at ways to improve one's own immune system or to basically deal with the prevention side of medical care rather than the cure side.
What are some of the corporations involved in modern medicine, and how did they affect their control?
Well, some of the largest chemical companies in the world were, for example, BASF, which derives from a company that was founded in Germany in the early 20th century called IG Farben. And it was a drug and chemical cartel that was founded by some of the largest chemical companies in Germany at that time. And it became one of the largest industrial manufacturers in the world, in fact, only behind Standard Oil of New Jersey and a few other companies to take the largest company spot. And after World War II, IG Farben was disbanded because of its help in the rise of the Third Reich. But exactly like Standard Oil, which was broken up in the early part of the 20th century, but in fact just became an even larger corporation, really, or a series of corporations when it was disbanded, IG Farben was likewise. So BASF, of course, remains one of the largest chemical companies in the world today, as are a couple of other offshoots that I think will be well known to the audience, Bayer and Sanofi, which are some of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world. And again, this ties directly back to the oligarchical influence that we've seen with IG Farben having been not only itself a petrochemical and company, but also one that had on its board Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who I mentioned before was part of the Royal Dutch Shell conglomerate. So again, this traces back to the same families that have been together with this petrochemical interest since the beginning. And to this day, I mean, Bayer and Sanofi remain some of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world and extremely profitable companies for those involved with them.
Let's talk about food. What is the Green Revolution, and does it differ from the Gene Revolution?
Well, yes, at least in a manner of speaking. The Green Revolution dates back to the 1940s, and it dates back to, in most readings of history, it dates back to Norman Borlaug, who was a researcher who was investigating various forms of wheat and maize and other crops that were being cultivated in Mexico. And his task was to try to find crops that would be more resistant to various problems that Mexican farmers would have. And part of his research involved finding new strains, creating new strains of wheat and other crops that would be more responsive to the Mexican farmers and their plights. And he was quite successful in that. And through a variety of techniques, he was able to breed new strains of wheat, for example, that were much more resilient and provided a lot greater crops yield. And as a result of that, and the application of his various techniques in various places around the world, we had what is called the Green Revolution, basically an enormous increase in yields that took place throughout the 1950s and 60s and 70s that was enabled by this revolution through these modified strains, but also through the introduction of modern industrial farming techniques. And of course, as it turns out, Norman Borlaug was a researcher for the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation and associated interests in a number of petrochemical and associated companies started to fund, to the tune of billions of dollars, the cultivation of these crops in various third world countries. And of course, also attendant with it, the creation of the modern agribusiness cartels, including ABCD Seed Cartel, Archer Daniel Midland, Bunge, Cargill, Louis Dreyfus. Some of these companies really started to consolidate control over world food supplies at that time, and continue to in the present day. And of course, this was again directly beneficial to the oligarchs themselves, who, of course, as one of their petrochemical derivatives is petrochemically derived fertilizers. So you had fertilizer companies like DuPont and Hercules Powder and others that were able to directly benefit from this. But then, of course, there was also the secondary or tertiary benefits of this that also accrued to the oligarchs in the form of the modern industrial practices that were being spread around the world at the same time as this Green Revolution, with fertilizers and tractors and irrigation. Of course, all of these modern farm implements running on oil and oil's supplied energy from, of course, the oligarchs themselves. And a lot of this was financed through the U.S. government, through U.S. aid programs, including President Johnson's Food for Peace program. So basically, the agribusiness giants were making direct profits from this Green Revolution via the U.S. government and ultimately the U.S. taxpayers, and in the service of this spreading of the Green Revolution around the globe. And the Green Revolution has been sold as this great success story, but there are, of course, numerous downsides that have taken place as a result of it as well. First of all, it's not at all clear that the enormous increases in yields that we saw in the middle of the 20th century were directly related to the Green Revolution itself. In fact, in India, research has shown that the pace of the crop yield increases actually started to slow after the introduction of the Green Revolution, because of disparate ways that this was being applied in different areas. And it also had real social costs in a lot of places. Basically, this tended to benefit people who were rich landowners already, at the expense of the farm-working peasants, who were more and more being replaced, basically, by automation, and had to move to urban slums and try to find ways of making money, usually by ending up in third world condition sweatshop like condition factories producing goods for multinational conglomerates. So there was a lot of downside to the Green Revolution, but it's usually talked about as some sort of great success.
I'm speaking with writer and producer James Corbett. Today's show: Oil and 9/11, Crossroads of Corruption and Criminality. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
The Green Revolution ultimately, of course, just parlayed into the Gene Revolution, which is what is the moniker for the modern, what they call the biotech industry revolution of the food supply, which is now looking at various ways to scientifically engineer at the genetic level various strains of different crops that will be even more resistant and supposedly require less fertilizers and other chemical inputs. Although actually research shows that genetically modified crops actually require more fertilizers than did their non-genetically modified brethren. So it, again, is a revolution that may be more hype than it is actually delivering. But at any rate, it is, of course, once again, populated by the same petrochemical interests. You have all of the IG Farben offshoots with their own biotech branches. You have Bayer Crop Science, you have BASF Plant Science, you have Dow AgroScience, you have DuPont Biotechnology, and a lot of other related firms with oligarchical interests. But on top of that, you have a dizzying array of different research institutes and societies that have been created directly through Rockefeller or Rockefeller-associated money in the past few decades to try to spread this gene revolution. There's the International Rice Research Institute, which, of course, is Rockefeller-funded. You have the International Service for the Acquisition of Agrobiotech Applications, which is a Rockefeller/Monsanto/USAID conglomerate. You have the Consultative Group of International Agriculture Research, which was created by the World Bank in association with the Rockefeller and Ford Foundations. So a lot of these same monies are accruing to this gene revolution, which is really just the furtherance of the green revolution, and in many ways represents a really worrying monopolization of the building blocks of life itself when you start looking at the ways that the gene revolution relies on these genetically modified crops, which are patented and patentable, and these companies are not afraid to use them. In fact, they already have in numerous locations used the philanthropic cover to introduce these genetically modified strains in the midst of severe droughts and other problems with harvests, and then actually gone and tried to sue farmers or entire countries, in fact, that were trying to use these products, these genetically modified products, without paying the proper royalties. In fact, that's exactly what happened in Argentina, where Monsanto did exactly that and then ended up trying to demand royalties from Argentina farmers for planting their crops. So this is, again, going on, and it represents not only billions upon billions upon billions of dollars for the companies involved in these biotech conglomerates, but, of course, also, again, a worrying consolidation of control of the seed supply itself in the hands of very few companies.
Well, that's right. In addition to that, of course, the very big questions about the health effects for people who eat these genetically modified foods, that's a whole other subject as well. As you point out, funding of the gene revolution is provided by the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and other such organizations. What is the ultimate goal of all of this control?
Well, this is really, I think, the important thing for people to grasp. Once again, I don't think that ultimately the monetary incentive is the only one at work here. I think that's the easily understandable one. And of course, there are, as I say, there are numerous corporations that are making billions upon billions of dollars through the spreading of this green slash gene revolution around the world. But I think it's at this point, when you look at some of the oligarchs themselves, I don't think money is necessarily the driving factor behind this. I think that we have to start to understand that this is ultimately about control of society, control of the very genetic code of the planet itself. And that might sound outlandish until you start to piece all of these different pieces of the puzzle together. Control over education, control over medicine, control over plants and agriculture, start to form a control grid which really does look like a monopolization of almost every aspect of life as we know it. And the question is there an ideology behind this, an ideology driving it? And the answer is a resounding yes. And in fact, that is exactly what I'm going to get into in the follow-up to this documentary, which I hope to have released in the next month or two, which will be looking at the ideology of control that is really driving the oligarchs. And it has its roots in late 19th century development of the pseudoscience, the now discredited pseudoscience of eugenics, that was largely funded and helped by, of course, the Rockefellers in the American context through American research centers like the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory and the American Eugenics Society, and around the world, including, of course, in Germany through the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, and how that eugenics idea, which is basically the idea that there are certain people who are just genetically superior to others and thus have a sort of modern scientific divine right to rule, is the modern scientific gloss on that. And that ultimately was parlayed into a type of crypto-eugenics after World War II and the discrediting of eugenics as pseudoscience, which took on the form of overpopulation fear-mongering and has really taken on the form, the guise of concern about climate. And I think that's going to be the next way in which this agenda of control is being foisted on the public.
Well, as you say in your part four, conclusion, monopolizing life, you say that the aim was much greater than a mere oil monopoly. It was the quest to monopolize all aspects of life. And I think you've just laid that out pretty clearly. I'm very much looking forward to the second installment of these documentaries. I'll have to hand it to you for putting these things together. This must entail an awful lot of work on your part.
It is an incredible amount of work. I guess I have the advantage that I've now been researching these subjects for the last 10 years, and so I've accrued an awful lot of information. The real hardest part of it is trying to distill it down to an hour and 15 minutes and have it make sense. I think you'll find in my podcast archives, I've talked about a lot of these subjects before, maybe not some of these details, but these subjects, broadly speaking, I've talked about at great length in many, many different hours of many different podcasts. But trying to distill it down is the hardest part. So really, the writing of this this transcript took about a month and a half to put together. And of course, there was about a month of video editing that my video editor did an excellent job of putting this together. But really, it does represent the culmination of upwards of a decade of research.
Well, I'm not surprised to hear that. And of course, when I was watching your hour and 15 minute documentary, whoa, I had to keep stopping and thinking, because it goes by very quickly. And as I said before, and you've reiterated, it covers a vast amount of subjects, very complex. James, I'd like to now talk about another documentary that you made on 9/11. In your documentary, 9/11 Trillions, Follow the Money, An Investigation of the 9/11 Money Trail, you begin with the question, what was 9/11? A terrorist atrocity? An attack on America? The first salvo in a new war? A day that changed everything? Well, that's a very good question. What was 9/11 in your opinion?
I think first and foremost, we have to understand 9/11 as a crime. And I don't think this is just a matter of semantics. I think it's extremely important the way that we approach 9/11, what it was, in order to determine how we should approach understanding it, trying to piece it together and understand what happened. If we take it as an act of war, a terrorist atrocity, if we just immediately start to do that, we put it into a framework where we have already assumed the conclusion. We know who is behind it, we know what it was done for, and we know how to respond. And that's, of course, exactly what took place. And we saw we're still living through all of the various ramifications of that, including not only, of course, the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, still ongoing to this day, but, of course, ultimately the invasion of Iraq, which was largely predicated on the fear that was induced on 9/11. And we are still, obviously, with ISIS, living through the ramifications of that. So I think it's extremely important to understand that 9/11 essentially was a crime. It was a crime perpetrated by, there have been the people identified by the 9/11 Commission as the 19 hijackers, but more importantly, crimes do not take place, generally speaking, or certainly not crimes of this magnitude, just by a few individuals just deciding to get on a plane one day. There is a conspiracy behind them, necessarily, by definition. If they have conspired to bring this about, there is a conspiracy. So I think we have to try to understand that. And of course, when we look at it as a crime, one of the key investigative tools for any would-be investigator of any crime is follow the money. This is a dictum that is well known because it does tend to work. We can understand the connections. We can start to piece together how the crime was committed and why it was committed if we start to look at the various ways that it was funded and the ramifications of this. What kind of monetary effects did this have? And I think when we put 9/11 in that context, we have a vastly different story going on than what we've been presented with in the news media as the official story of 9/11.
You begin your documentary on 9/11 with the heist. You state that in 1998, the New York, New Jersey Port Authority decided to privatize the World Trade Center complex, and that in April of 2001, an agreement was reached with a consortium of investors led by Silverstein Properties, and that in July of 2001, a 99-year lease was signed with Larry Silverstein. How was this deal unusual?
Well, there were a few things that were unusual about it, one of which was that the Port Authority had only insured the WTC Center for $1.5 billion. And in fact, earlier, I believe earlier in 2001, the entire complex had been estimated at a value of $1.2 billion. And yet Silverstein insisted on insuring $3.55 billion, which is a doubling of the amount of insurance that the Port Authority had on it, which, again, is somewhat unusual. And in fact, was such a large deal that it was very difficult to put together. Silverstein's insurance broker ultimately had to split the coverage up amongst 25 different dealers. It was a very complex negotiation that was still ongoing as September 11th unfolded. There was preliminary agreements in place, but it had not all been finalized, which led to the years and years of court battles that we saw in the years afterwards, with Silverstein being embroiled in all sorts of court actions against his insurers, trying to claim not only, of course, the $3.55 billion that the World Trade Center had been insured for under that deal, but in fact, $7.1 billion, because as he immediately, in the wake of 9/11, tried to claim, this was not one, but two acts of terrorism, and thus counted double for the insurance purposes. So that was fairly unusual. Also, just the fact that this was a 99-year lease that specifically included provisions in the event of the destruction of the towers that would allow Silverstein Properties to rebuild in that area and to increase the amount of commercial space available in that area, which is interesting because, of course, prior to 9/11, the World Trade Center was not a prime real estate property. It was not fully leased. It was, in fact, an aging building that had many problems, or major buildings that had many problems with them, including asbestos problems that were going to require a large amount of money to solve. And in fact, they were not a particularly, other than the prestige associated, of course, with being the leaseholder of the World Trade Center, there were a lot of problems with the buildings themselves. Well, that seemed to have been taken care of, I suppose, in just literally weeks after the ink was dry on that deal.
I'm speaking with writer and producer James Corbett. Today's show, Oil and 9/11, Crossroads of Corruption and Criminality. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Is it also true that Larry Silverstein took out insurance against a terrorist attack?
Terrorist events were part of the coverage. My understanding is that that was not, in and of itself, unusual. Of course, his trying to make the two plane strikes count for two different terror attacks was somewhat beyond the pale. But he ultimately did end up making over $4 billion in insurance coverage, and he had only insured for $3.55 billion. So the courts ultimately handed him something of a victory in that regard. And ultimately, he did profit from the attacks directly.
You say that a much deeper, more complex, and well-hidden heist was taking place behind closed doors on September 11th, 2001. What can you tell us about this deeper heist? First of all, what is Marsh & McLennan?
Marsh & McLennan bills itself as a diversified risk insurance and professional services firm, ultimately a type of insurance agent, that currently has over 57,000 employees and brings in revenues of over $13 billion every year. At the time of 9/11, they occupied floors 93 to 100 in the North Tower of the World Trade Center, and they had hundreds of employees working there. And this is important because Marsh had recently, just prior to the attacks, contracted with a firm called Silverstream Software to try to create an electronic connection between Marsh and some of its premier clients for paperless transactions. Nothing of this sort had been accomplished or even attempted before this point, and so they were really trying to pioneer something with this. So some of their largest clients included Merrill Lynch and Deutsche Bank and Bankers Trust and Alex Brown, Morgan Stanley, and other financial services firms that were contracting with Marsh. And so they were creating this special proprietary electronic paperless transactions software system. And in fact, they ultimately ended up winning a type of industry, insurance industry insider kind of award called the Accord Award, I believe in 2001, specifically for developing that system shortly before the 9/11 attacks. And this software, the extent of it is not really publicly known, but we do have one person who is working on that deal as a sales representative for Silverstream who has come out and talked about the deal itself. And his name is Richard Grove. He now has his own podcast and runs his own website at tragedyandhope.com. But he was part of this this deal as a sales representative who started to notice anomalies in the way that this contract was being billed. And basically, to the tune of millions of dollars, money was being put into this this deal that wasn't making its way through the system properly. And he was trying to sort this out with various people, both at Silverstream and at Marsh and at Marsh's clients. And this started to become a major issue. And ultimately, on 9/11 itself, there was a meeting that was taking place that we do have independent confirmation that this took place from Marsh's chief information officer, Ellen Clark, in a 2006 interview. There was a meeting that was taking place in Marsh's offices in the World Trade Center on 9/11. That was specifically going to hear about these suspicious parts of this contract that was taking place. Now, obviously, in the North Tower on 9/11, where this conference call was taking place, none of the employees involved in that conference call survived. Richard Grove, who was stuck in traffic on the way to the World Trade Center, as he was supposed to make an appearance at that conference call, ultimately didn't make it there and survived to tell the tale. Now, the interesting part of this comes in the wake of 9/11, when there was a German company called Convar Infosys that was hired to try to recover some of the information from the hard drives at the World Trade Center. And there was quite a bit of coverage about this in December of 2001, including a Reuters article and Fox News, I believe, covered at CNN. Talking about the investigation that Convar was involved in trying to recover this information from the damaged hard drives. And as a representative of Convar at that time, Peter Herschel talked about, they started to find a large number of anomalous and unexplained transactions in the immediate lead up to and during the attacks themselves on 9/11. And Peter Herschel, the Convar's director, said, the suspicion is that inside information about the attack was used to send financial transaction commands and authorizations in the belief that amid all the chaos, the criminals would have, at the very least, a good head start. And this is interesting because we also have from Michael Rupert, who I believe you've talked to in the past, one of the former Deutsche Bank employees who was working in the World Trade Center at that time, talked to him about how the computer systems in Deutsche Bank in the Twin Towers were being, quote unquote, taken over, co-opted and run by something. They didn't know where it was coming from. There was a massive data purge, a massive data download as the attacks were happening. And of course, all of this swirls around the E-Link clients that Silverstream Software was developing with Marsh for its key contractors. So all of this seems to indicate, and again, Convar did start to find hard data backing up the fact that there were anomalous transactions taking place in the World Trade Center at the time of 9/11. But interestingly enough, that Convar investigation was ultimately quashed, and the FBI will no longer talk about it. Convar itself will no longer talk about it. They will not even confirm that they ever did this work, although they do talk about it in promotional materials. When asked by interviewers about the information, what they found, what kind of transactions they were looking at, how much, they will now not talk about it at all, simply saying that that investigation was over and they're not allowed to talk about it anymore. We do know that the FBI was one of the investigative agencies that was getting information from this, but they have not released any reports on what was found in the Convar information. So we know that there was anomalous transactions taking place. We know that there was this unusual, unprecedented e-link that was being forged in the months prior to 9/11 between Marsh and McLennan and its various contractors. And we have testimony from a Deutsche Bank employee that there was something very anomalous happening during the attacks themselves. But we don't really have ultimately any answer as to what this all was, because unfortunately, again, all of these investigations have been quashed and come to an end.
Now, did Richard Grove work for Silverstream or for Marsh?
He was working for Silverstream Software, specifically as a sales representative. He was selling the software that Silverstream was developing to Marsh so that Marsh could develop this e-link software.
I see. And yes, you mentioned Michael Rupert. Just as an aside, the first program that I ever produced on Guns and Butter was actually a little half-hour program live with Mike Rupert 1 month after 9/11. It was going to be an economic show on the put options, and of course it turned into a show on 9/11. And so I've found this subject following me around ever since. What did you discover in your research about insider trading in the days leading up to and on September 11th?
Well, as you say, Michael Rupert did do pioneering work on this issue, and it's one that's somewhat understood by, I think, a lot of the public at this point, but really only in a tiny little way. A lot of people have heard about the put options that were put on various airlines, the American Airlines and United Airlines, that were, of course, obviously adversely affected by 9/11. And that is a part of the story, and it was one that was well covered in the first couple of months after 9/11, even in mainstream locations. ABC News and others covered it, talking about some of these put options. And to put it into perspective, for example, you have put options on United Airlines that were put in the days prior to 9/11 that were relatively small, $180,000, but in the wake of 9/11 and, of course, the plunging of United Airlines stocks, that turns into $2.4 million. So millions of dollars of benefits. And that's just one example of one of the trades that was made. And I think the impression that a lot of people have is that, well, this was investigated and they found that there was really nothing behind it and it's been overhyped. Quite the contrary. In fact, there have been three different scientific studies that have taken place over the past 10 years that have demonstrated that there is a statistically identifiable increase in put option activity, unusual increase in option activity in the S&P and Dow Jones in lead up to 9/11 that are suggestive of advanced knowledge of the attacks. And it isn't just airlines. There was a number of put options on a number of companies that were directly impacted by 9/11, including Boeing, Merrill Lynch, J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, Munich Re, the AXA Group. Marsh & McLennan was one of the major companies that were implicated in this options trading. But also on the other side, not just put options, but call options, i.e. basically bets that the stock was going to increase, were also put in an anomalous way on Raytheon stock, which at the time was $25. Of course, after the invasion of Afghanistan, which was heavily supplied by Raytheon Tomahawk missiles, that stock went up to $34, a 37% increase. So again, there was a lot of different trades made on a lot of different stocks in the immediate run-up to 9/11. We're talking days and weeks prior to 9/11 that ultimately ended up paying millions and millions of dollars. The official investigation of this by the FBI ultimately concluded that we have not developed any evidence suggesting that those who had advanced knowledge of the September 11th attacks traded on the basis of that information, which seems to be, at first glance, a denial that there had been any advanced trading taking place. But in fact, when you look at that, they say that there is no evidence suggesting that those who had advanced knowledge traded on the basis of that information, which of course begs the question, how did the FBI, how did the Department of the Treasury, how did the SEC determine who had advanced knowledge of the attacks, especially when there seems to be advanced knowledge in the very act of placing these bets themselves? And that question is begged even more when you look at some of the leads that were deliberately not followed up by the FBI. For example, a briefing document from the FBI in 2003 that was declassified in 2009 identified a couple of individuals who, for example, had purchased 56,000 shares of Stratesec stock in the days prior to 9/11, stock that did go up. They provide security systems to airports, which of course saw an increase in revenues in the wake of 9/11 and the increased security procedures that were implemented. Incidentally, they were also in charge of security at Dulles and World Trade Center and United Airlines, so they were also implicated in the quote-unquote failure of 9/11, but their stock did go up. So this purchase of 56,000 shares in the days prior to 9/11 was of interest, but the FBI decided not to even interview the people who had bought these stocks because the investigation found that they revealed no ties to terrorism or other negative information. And Kevin Ryan, who I believe you've also interviewed on this program, has talked about how that was ultimately, it was Wirt Dexter Walker III, a distant relative of George W. Bush, President Bush, but also a business partner of Marvin Bush, the president's brother. So these were a couple of the people who were identified in that FBI investigation and not even interviewed because they had no conceivable ties to terrorism. Therefore, they could not have been trading on advanced knowledge. So I think that goes to show that the FBI investigation was ultimately an open question itself. How did they know that these people had no advanced knowledge?
Visit gunsandbutter.org to hear the remainder of this interview and read a transcript. James Corbett, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Been speaking with James Corbett. Today's show has been Oil and 9/11, Crossroads of Corruption and Criminality. James Corbett is the producer and host of The Corbett Report, an internet-based, independent, listener-supported alternative news source that has attracted a large audience. The Corbett Report is edited, webmastered, written, produced, and hosted by James Corbett. It includes a weekly podcast and several regular online video series. James Corbett has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started the Corbett Report website in 2007 as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He is also an editorial writer for the International Forecaster, the weekly e-newsletter created by the late Bob Chapman. Visit the Corbett Report website at corbettreport.com. That's CORBETT report.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yarrow Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at G&B Radio.
Hey, yo. You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
For Memorial Day, New World Notes rebroadcasts our strongest anti-war program to date. It's from May 2009, and I think just as cogent today as it was then. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to New World Notes, a series that explores the gap between the America we want and the America they're trying to make us settle for, and how we the people can reestablish our commonwealth and reclaim our democracy. Edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. The Slippery Slope of Memorial Day. Today we'll take on Memorial Day and wrestle it to the ground. I'll rip a patriotic poem to shreds. Robert Fisk will talk about war. After a Canadian anti-war song, I'll read Howard Zinn's essay on Memorial Day, the one that got him fired from the Boston Globe. So, fire up the grill, uncap a returnable glass bottle of some fizzy liquid, and turn up the radio. It's Memorial Day 2009, or pretty close. And if I had any sense, I'd add, may God rest the dead and forgive the living, and spend the next 26 minutes talking about organic farming, or maybe the assassination of William McKinley. But I've got to wade waist-deep in the big muddy, because Memorial Day brings together too many important themes of this program. Themes like the abuse, degradation, and destruction of our soldiers by our chicken hawk patriots with American flag pins on their lapels. Especially those chicken hawk patriots that stand to make a buck out of whichever war we're killing our young people with at the moment. Memorial Day is the occasion to make senseless bloodbaths that destroy soldiers and civilians alike, that enrich only the most vicious of the already rich, that violate almost every ethical and moral precept that parents and priests and school teachers teach their children. This infernal butchery is now passed off as noble and holy. Doce et decorum est pro patria mori, etc., etc. As I said, and in English, the sensible fellow wouldn't bring up any of this, especially in a patriotistic week such as this one. And if patriotistic isn't a word, it darn well ought to be. Here's a phrase, rote learned, that said a lot on Memorial Day. He gave his life to defend his country. Wrong on two counts. First, he didn't willingly give his life. They took it. Second, at the very least for the past 60 years, he wasn't defending his country. He was defending the profits of transnational corporations that don't give a damn about his country and ours. That's why their new factories are in Kuala Lumpur, and they pay their corporate taxes to the Cayman Islands. When the soldier was killed invading Panama in 1989, was he defending the homeland against the Panamanians? When she was killed in Afghanistan, did she give her life in order to defend America against Afghani invaders arriving in transport ships? How about Iraq? As Cindy Sheehan famously asked, what was the noble cause for which her son was sacrificed, along now with 4,500 other sons and daughters? How about Grenada, 1983? Does anyone even remember the official pretext for sending troops marching into Grenada? Can anyone even find Grenada on a map? Memorial Day is perched on a slippery slope. We show our respect for the dead, for Americans who obeyed orders they couldn't refuse and were killed. That is worthy. Then we slide down the slope to honoring the bloody, aggressive state policies that caused the deaths. Honor these policies by intentionally confusing them with defending our country. That is unworthy. Then we slide down further and turn the memorial into propaganda, supporting whatever bloody aggression the ruling elite are conducting at the moment. And propaganda for ever higher public expenditures to make future acts of bloody aggression even more profitable for the ruling elite. This is obscene. Then we slide to the very bottom and proclaim that we must commit ever larger acts of bloody aggression. To fail to do so would be to dishonor the military dead of the past. This is beyond obscene. This is blasphemy. So, on Memorial Day, we turn slaughter into sacrifice into sacrilege. You'll recall that at one point, the only public reason to continue occupying Iraq that Bush could come up with was this. If we give Iraq back to the Iraqis, or cut and run, as he put it, if we fail to stay the course, this would dishonor the 2,500 American soldiers who were killed in Iraq to that time. Okay, now we've killed nearly twice as many. Can we go home now? Or would that dishonor the nearly 5,000 Americans killed in Iraq to date? Surely the best way to honor them is to stay the course until we've killed 5,000 more, right? In a minute, we'll hear journalist Robert Fisk and his thoughts on war. But first, a little poem. It's only 15 lines, divided into three short stanzas. It's the most famous Memorial Day poem in the world. It was written by a Canadian military officer, John McCrae, in his notebook in May 1915 in the Flanders region of Belgium, the day after a friend had been killed in battle. Here's what I admire about McCrae. Later, he reread the poem, ripped it out of his notebook, presumably crumpled it up, and discarded it. Unfortunately, another officer retrieved the page and mailed it to England to be published in the popular magazine Punch. I like to think that McCrae chucked the poem because he realized that the third stanza falsified the truth about warfare and so dishonored his late friend and comrade. Literary scholar Paul Fussell wrote that, in describing the third stanza, quote, words like vicious and stupid would not seem to go too far, unquote. For here, the dead soldiers are calling out from their graves, essentially, stay the course, for cutting and running would dishonor us. World War I continued for another 3.5 years after the poem was written. In the end, 20 million soldiers died in that war, including McCrae himself. For what noble cause? In this poem, we see the whole slippery slope of Memorial Day. The poem starts out as a nice little elegy expressing respect and sadness for the dead soldiers now buried in Flanders Fields. That's the title, of course. The poem ends in bathos, propaganda, and jingoism. Here it is, then on to Robert Fisk. In Flanders Fields the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row that mark our place, and in the sky the larks, still bravely singing, fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders Fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you, from failing hands, we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders Fields. Here's Robert Fisk.
You know, over and over again, and journalists forget this, We constantly, when we want to go to war, we evoke World War II. Always. At the time of the Suez Crisis in 1956, Anthony Eden, British Prime Minister, called Nasser the Mussolini of the Nile. And of course, when we wanted to go to war in Iraq, well, not us, but they wanted to go to war in Iraq, Saddam became the Hitler of the Tigris River, the Hitler of Baghdad. And we were all entitled to become Winston Churchill. And anyone who objected to the war, they were an appeaser like Neville Chamberlain. You know the story, the way it goes. And therefore, of course, we can then justify war. Not as the reality of war actually is, which is the total failure of the human spirit. It's about death, not about primarily victory or defeat. But as a policy option. You see, that's how we get the permission. The Archbishop of Canterbury, poor soul, actually said that the 1991 Gulf War was a just war. And if you saw what I see on battlefields in the Middle East, at massacres, bodies torn apart, the famous highway of death, there were actually two highways of death, north of Kuwait in 1991, where the British, as well as the American Air Force, had bombed and bombed and bombed, not just the military, but refugee cars as well. And there in the desert were men, some of them soldiers, some not, women and children, being torn apart, dead, by dogs. It was lunchtime. And bits of them, arms, fingers, being taken off to be eaten in the desert. You don't see that. If you saw what I see on battlefields, you would never, ever support a war or talk about just wars. But I've been over and over again confronted, particularly in British Commonwealth countries, by the argument, but don't you think World War II was just? And since my father, who was much older than my mum, fought in the First World War and has signed up to be the resistance leader in southern England after the German invasion, which of course mercifully never came because he would have been executed as a terrorist, no doubt. I think, yes, my father was right to be prepared to fight for England. Yes, the Royal Air Force was right to fight the Battle of Britain. But the World War II is finished. You know, when Menachem Begin was sending the Israeli army up to Beirut in 1982, he wrote this crazed letter to President Ronald Reagan saying he felt as if he was advancing on Berlin with Hitler in his bunker, Hitler being the pathetic and corrupt Arafat. And, you know, there was a very good piece written by Uri Avneri, a very brave Israeli journalist whom most of you will know of. He wrote an open letter to Menachem Begin, who, of course, then was the Israeli Prime Minister, and it began, "Dear Mr. Prime Minister, Hitler is dead." And I feel more and more we need to have a cut-off line after World War II. You know, after the Second World War, we introduced legislation and human rights codes and regulations to prevent World War III. We had new protocols of the International Red Cross, part of which was founded on the Hague Convention, which was before the First World War. We had the UN, the General Assembly, the Security Council. The European Union was founded as a coal and trade organization between Germany and France to prevent another Battle of the Verdun, World War I, and to prevent another occupation of Paris by the German army. Germany and France would never go to war again, nor would Europe. We'd better forget Bosnia at the moment. But we laid down a forest of laws to protect human rights, to protect us. And they were good laws. And we were right to do what we did. I believe in the UN, despite the fact that it's a friendly old donkey that comes clip-clopping in at the end when we need it. But it's there to be used. And I don't think after World War II, I think it's very hard to find a just war or an excuse for a just war. Korea? At times, at the beginning perhaps. But was Vietnam just? Was Yemen a just war? The British fought in Yemen, the British fight against Aoka in Cyprus, or Mau Mau in Kenya, or in Palestine? Look, was the partition of India a just thing? Was Northern Ireland just? Was the Iran-Iraq war just? 8 years, 1.5 million dead? I watched many of them die. I don't think just war exists anymore. I think, though, we need that cut-off point after World War II. And I think many Arabs whom I talk to say the same thing. They believe the same thing. You know, one of the strange things is that we have this idea that in some way the Arab Muslim world don't know what we know, that they don't have the advantages, of course, of our civilization. I don't think we care about them very much. That's why we don't know how many have died in Iraq. The only time that President Bush was asked how many Iraqis were killed, he gave a hopeless underestimate. He said, 30,000. But what he actually said was 30,000 more or less. Well, more or less? Can you imagine if I've been asked how many American troops had died in Iraq, and he said, oh, 4,000 more or less. It would have been scandalous. But it's okay if it's about the Iraqis. We're going to give them democracy. We're going to give Iraq human rights. We've had a surge, which means escalation, by the way, if you're using Vietnam speak. So it's okay. The fact that the casualties have fallen because the Shiites have ethnically cleansed all the Sunnis out of the mixed areas doesn't matter. I mean, how many Iraqis have been killed? 250,000? 500,000? 1,000,000? More? I have no idea. But perhaps, I don't know. And we will never know. And we're not meant to know. And we don't care. You know, there was a CIA officer came up to me with a huge pistol on his belt in the Spanish base near Kufa. This is after the Madrid bombings, but before the Spanish withdrew. And he said, you know, he said, there are dozens of armed men on the streets at night, in the country roads. I said, of course, it's an insurgency. He said, what could we have done to stop this? And I said, well, when you reached Baghdad, you might have pitched a huge tent city for every sick and wounded Iraqi outside Baghdad and give them your help and help the suffering Iraqis and show your love for them. But you didn't do that. I've said this before. I've said it in California before. You know, I think the Arabs would like some of our democracy. After all, they've tolerated all these dictators whom we support and all the torture chambers which we accept and all the police torturers, many of whom have been trained by us. They would like some of our democracy. And I think they'd like some packages of human rights from our supermarket shelves. But the freedom that I am always asked about in Lebanon, where I live, is that the Arabs would like freedom from us. And this we do not intend to give them. Was Iraq about oil? Well, if the Iraqi national product had been asparagus or carrots, the 82nd Airborne would not be in Mosul or Baghdad. Of course it wouldn't.
Here's a song recorded in the Vietnam era that I think still works. It shows an America whose bloody wars of aggression are ordered not by the real America, but by a cabal of the elite, here called the Monster. The singer, supposedly a young peace activist, is appealing to citizens to act in accord with real American values and stop the insane bloodbath we're waging overseas.
Country to build a new vision, far from the riches of kingdom and gold. While we bullied, stolen, bought a homeland, we begin the slaughter of the red man. But still come near and far to seek America. They came by thousands to conquer the world. But she just patiently smiled and wore a child. Sleeping. Now it's a monster and will not obey.
That was Steppenwolf. Historian Howard Zinn wrote a biweekly column for the Boston Globe from 1974 to 1976. This is his last column. They canceled his contract as soon as this one appeared in print. It was written right after the end of the Vietnam War. The title is, Whom Will We Honor Memorial Day? Memorial Day will be celebrated as usual by high-speed collisions of automobiles and bodies strewn on highways and the sound of ambulance sirens throughout the land. It will also be celebrated by the display of flags, the sound of bugles and drums, by parades and speeches and unthinking applause. It will be celebrated by giant corporations, which make guns, bombs, fighter planes, aircraft carriers, and an endless assortment of military junk, and which await the $100 billion in contracts to be approved soon by Congress and the President. Memorial Day will be celebrated, in other words, by the usual betrayal of the dead, by the hypocritical patriotism of the politicians and contractors preparing for more wars, more graves to receive more flowers on future Memorial Days. The memory of the dead deserves a different dedication. To peace, to defiance of governments. There was a young woman in New Hampshire who refused to allow her husband, killed in Vietnam, to be given a military burial. She rejected the hollow ceremony ordered by those who sent him and 50,000 others to their deaths. Her courage should be cherished on Memorial Day. There were the B-52 pilots who refused to fly those last vicious raids of Nixon's and Kissinger's war. Have any of the great universities, so quick to give honorary degrees to God knows whom, thought to honor those men at this commencement time, on this Memorial Day? No politician who voted funds for war, no business contractor for the military, no general who ordered young men into battle, no FBI man who spied on anti-war activities should be invited to public ceremonies on this sacred day. Let the dead of past wars be honored. Let those who live pledge themselves never to embark on mass slaughter again. Quote, the shell had his number on it. The blood ran into the ground. Where his chest ought to have been, they pilled the Congressional Medal, the DSC, the Medaille Militaire, the Belgian Croix de Guerre, the Italian Gold Medal, the Virtutita Militaria sent by Queen Marie of Romania. All of Washingtonians brought flowers. Woodrow Wilson brought a bouquet of poppies. Those are the concluding lines of John Dos Passos' angry novel, 1919. Let us honor him on Memorial Day. And also Thoreau, who went to jail to protest the Mexican War. And Mark Twain, who denounced our war against the Filipinos at the turn of the century. And I.F. Stone, who, virtually alone among newspaper editors, exposed the fraud and brutality of the Korean War. Let us honor Martin Luther King, who refused the enticements of the White House and the cautions of associates, and thundered against the war in Vietnam. Memorial Day should be a day for putting flowers on graves and planting trees. Also for destroying the weapons of death that endanger us more than they protect us, that waste our resources and threaten our children and grandchildren. On Memorial Day, we should take note that, in the name of defense, our taxes have been used to spend $250 million on a helicopter assault ship called the Biggest Floating Lemon, which was accepted by the Navy, though it had over 2,000 major defects at the time of its trial cruise. Meanwhile, there is such a shortage of housing that millions live in dilapidated sections of our cities, and millions more are forced to pay high rents or high interest rates on their mortgages. There's $90 billion for the B-1 bomber, but people don't have money to pay hospital bills. We must be practical, say those whose practicality has consisted of a war every generation. We mustn't deplete our defenses, say those who have depleted our youth, stolen our resources. In the end, it is living people, not corpses, creative energy, not destructive rage, which are our only real defense, not just against other governments trying to kill us, but against our own also trying to kill us. Let us not set out this Memorial Day on the same old drunken ride to death. Thanks for listening. New World Notes is produced in the spacious underground studios of WWUHFM, a community service of the University of Hartford. For the words by Robert Fisk, our thanks to Mariah Gillardin and TUC Radio. New World Notes is available off the air by internet stream, podcast, or MP3 download at your convenience. There's an archive of shows you can download, a weekly newsletter, and a blog. All is free. For more information, start at the blog. We're at http://newworldnotes.blogspot.com. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent the views of the presenter, station management staff, or our gracious host and licensee, and they are protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Your feedback on this program is most welcome. Email kdowst, that's K-D-O-W-S-T, at hotmail.com. From darkest New England, this is Kenneth Doust, wishing you a good week, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and reminding you the only sane way to support our troops is to bring them home, every last one of them. Ciao!
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short head.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today, the focus is going to be on the 28 redacted pages from the Joint Congressional Inquiry into the intelligence failures on 9/11. So first, to set the stage, 9/11 happened, of course, in September of 2001, but the investigation didn't get up and running until February of 2002, a total of 5 months later.
Most inquiries into national tragedies get started within roughly a week of the event. With 9/11, there was great resistance to an investigation by the Bush administration and even by Senator Bob Graham himself initially. Perhaps one of the reasons for delaying an investigation for 5 months was that it gave the molten metal, which would have indicated that something much more powerful than jet fuel and office fires brought down the towers, and which was present for months after 9/11, it gave it time to cool and solidify. And waiting 5 months allowed for much of the evidence to be carted away and destroyed or shipped to China and India. And it also gave the government and their corporately controlled media time to drum the official conspiracy theory into all of our collective psyches over and over again. So in February 2002, the Joint Congressional Inquiry begins with Senator Bob Graham from Florida as head of the Senate Intelligence Committee and Congressman Porter Goss, also from Florida, as head of the House Intelligence Committee. Many of the alleged hijackers were coincidentally living in and attending flight school in Florida in the very same district that former CIA employee and now Congressman Porter Goss represented. In August of 2001, just weeks before 9/11, Senator Bob Graham and Congressman Porter Goss and Senator Kyle from Arizona visited Islamabad, Pakistan, and met with President Peres and the Director General of the ISI, Mahmoud Ahmed. And the ISI is the equivalent of our CIA. And on the morning of 9/11, Porter Goss and Bob Graham were having breakfast in Washington, D.C. with this same Director General of the ISI, Mahmoud Ahmed. Now, what makes this really interesting is that prior to 9/11, Mahmoud Ahmed had ordered $100,000 be sent to Muhammad Atta, the alleged ringleader of the alleged 9/11 hijackers. So here we have Senator Graham and Congressman Porter Goss pointing the finger at the Saudis for funding the alleged hijackers, when they themselves were having breakfast on 9/11 with a known supporter of the alleged hijackers. And yet they never mentioned this. They failed to ever mention this man's name or that he had given money to Muhammad Atta. So you have to ask yourself, what's really going on here? In a few minutes, we'll hear some audio clips that will shed some light on this. And it should be noted that the Joint Congressional Inquiry was only tasked with investigating intelligence failures surrounding 9/11. They went on the assumption that the Bush administration's official story of 9/11 was correct. You know the story. The 19 Middle Eastern men with box cutters who hijacked 4 planes, and then the towers collapsed from the jet fuel and ensuing office fires. So the Joint Congressional Investigation was not asked to and did not investigate what really caused the towers to explode. They didn't even question whether the alleged hijackers were really involved in 9/11. And just for the record, to this day, there is no evidence that they were ever on the planes, and there is evidence that 11 of them are still alive today. It was primarily pressure from the victims' family members that forced the Bush administration to set up the Joint Congressional Inquiry. But it was a cover-up investigation, and the family members were not satisfied, so they lobbied Congress for a new investigation, and this was how the 9/11 Commission came about. And their report came out in 2004. But it was set up to be another cover-up commission, and it's full of omissions and distortions. And if you would like to read about those omissions and distortions, you can get a copy of David Ray Griffin's book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. But back to the Joint Congressional Inquiry of 2002, here's Luke Rutkowski of the organization WeAreChange.org discussing the 28 pages PSYOP.
With the mainstream media and government officials calling for the release of the 28 censored classified pages from the 9/11 investigation, you have to ask yourself, is this just propaganda? Is it a limited hangout, a PSYOP, with a bigger geopolitical goal? In this video, we're going to go over this and the larger picture of exactly what is happening to give you the truth on this very important issue that has been highlighted in the American mainstream public. Now, as we are speaking, many people are calling to release these 28 pages from the 9/11 investigations, which people who have read within our government claim points a direct finger at Saudi Arabia financing the 9/11 attacks, the biggest terrorist attack on American soil. Now, with this happening, there's actually new evidence presented called Document 17. And as the Time writes today, new evidence has come to light of a definitive link between Saudi Arabian officials and the 9/11 terrorist attacks, further raising tensions as President Barack Obama travels to the kingdom. According to the report, Ghassan al-Shahbiri, a Saudi who became an al-Qaeda bomb maker, is believed to have taken flight lessons with some of the 9/11 hijackers in Arizona, but did not take part in the attacks on New York and the Pentagon that killed 3,000 people in 2001. He was captured in Pakistan in 2002 and has since been held at Guantanamo Bay. According to a U.S. memo known as Document 17, written in 2003 and quickly declassified last year, the FBI learned that he had buried a cache of papers shortly before he was captured. His U.S. flight certificate was in an envelope from the Saudi embassy in the United States in Washington, D.C. More information is coming to light with the direct finger pointing at Saudi Arabia financing the 9/11 attack. Now, why is this happening now? And because of all this new information, 9/11 victims' family members have put up a law in Congress that will allow them to sue Saudi Arabia for the 9/11 attacks. Saudi Arabia responded by saying it will liquidate its treasury holding, $750 billion from the U.S. economy, if their role in 9/11 is exposed. And of course, now Paul Ryan and Barack Obama plan to veto the bill, allowing the family members to sue Saudi Arabia. And the victims' family members are like, hey, whose side are you on? There's clear documentation, not only with the 28 pages, not only with this new Document 17, pointing with Saudi Arabia's role with 9/11. And the family members like, wait, what is going on here? Barack Obama came down to Ground Zero during one of the 9/11 anniversaries, spoke to the 9/11 victims' family members, and told them that he would release the 28 pages, and he has yet to do so. So what is happening here? Because we're obviously showing how the United States and Barack Obama are covering up the real truth behind 9/11. Well, with all of this happening, with many people saying that Saudi Arabia is threatening to destabilize and destroy the U.S. economy if their role of 9/11 is exposed, which kind of points to the fact that they are guilty of doing and participating in this crime. Well, Saudi Arabia called for and demanded a recalibration of relations with the United States. And of course, Barack Obama flew down and he's in Saudi Arabia right now, kissing the hands of the Saudi prince, bowing down to them to get rid of all these disputes. Now, why is there such a push from the establishment against Saudi Arabia right now? Well, there's something bigger happening geopolitically that people need to understand. The oil market and the hype and the crisis signal greater troubles ahead. Of course, with the lower oil and gas prices around the world, this is creating an economic shock for Saudi Arabia, which is even preparing for this globally. And they have started even selling off Saudi Aramco stocks in order to prepare for this new geopolitical landscape where oil is not as dominant as it was before. You see Saudi Arabia even moving away from oil, trying to save their economy, because ultimately the United States and Saudi Arabia had a very strong connection, a very strong alliance, mainly to prop up the petrodollar. And now Saudi Arabia moving away from oil, the petrodollar is at stake. This could be one reason why the United States establishment is pushing pressure on Saudi Arabia, saying, look, we could cause you a lot of trouble with this 9/11 information. You do not want to go against us. You do not want to go against the petrodollar. You better stay with us, or we're going to publicly shame you around the world for your participation in 9/11. This could be one of the reasons, but of course, it's not definitive. This is only an estimated guess with what is happening geopolitically. But what we are seeing is that the United States, not only President George W. Bush, but also President Barack Obama, are covering up the truth behind 9/11. Now, is this just one aspect of it? Of course, it gets a lot bigger and a lot more complicated, because you have to ask yourself, with the United States throwing Saudi Arabia underneath the bus right now, was it Saudi Arabia who made the largest Air Force in the world, NORAD, stand down on 9/11 for 2 hours as the terrorist attacks were happening here in the United States? Was it Saudi Arabia that stood down our Air Force and didn't intercept any of those airplanes when it was standard protocol to intercept them within 15 minutes whenever they had got? Of course, no. Saudi Arabia didn't do that. Is it Saudi Arabia keeping dozens of camera footage of exactly what happened to the Pentagon? No, it's the United States. The Pentagon released one short clip here of a couple seconds showing a mysterious flame. In reality, if it was a huge Boeing aircraft, we would have seen something like this, but we only seen this. And now the Pentagon, the most surveilled area in the world, is keeping secret all of the surveillance cameras, only releasing this one. Is it Saudi Arabia who's doing that? Was it Saudi Arabia who was a part of a secret Pentagon operation called Able Danger that identified the role of 9/11 ringleader Muhammad Atta and three other hijackers before 9/11 in a secret Pentagon program and then destroyed those documents? Was it Saudi Arabia? No. Was it Saudi Arabia who gave 15 of the 19 hijackers visas when they didn't qualify for them? No. It was a secret program under the State Department, with the CIA's involvement, as Michael Springman told everyone, as the whistleblower who came out with this very important information, documented exactly how he was denying known terrorist visas, and yet they were expedited through an express visa program run by the CIA, allowing Al-Qaeda into the United States. Those same 9/11 hijackers got the visas from the same consulate that he was working at and were allowed through the same express program to be allowed into the country with the upper echelon's CIA help to be in the United States. Was it Saudi Arabia who did that? No, it was our own government. There's a reason why Saudi Arabia is being thrown underneath the bus right now. The picture is a lot bigger for the big psyop that's happening right now with the 28 pages. It goes beyond that. The truth is extremely important for everyone to understand, not just a limited hangout. So share this with anyone who thinks these 28 pages are great that they're finally coming out, because the picture is, of course, a lot bigger.
And again, you were just listening to Luke Rudkowski of WeAreChange.org. And now here's James Corbett of theCorbettReport.com, also shedding some light on the geopolitics of what's really going on concerning those 28 redacted pages in the Joint Congressional Inquiry. This is from a recent interview that he did on the radio show Press for Truth Live with David Dawson. And here he is, James Corbett.
This is absolutely 100% a limited hangout that, as you say, was implanted in the official story of 9/11 since the very beginning. And we have to understand that there are several layers of spin behind which the actual story is hiding here. And surprise, surprise, guess what? The real truth about 9/11 isn't going to come out through 60 Minutes puff pieces quoting Senator Bob Graham or Porter Goss or characters like these who were intimately involved in what happened on 9/11. So we have to question why it's coming out right now. Firstly, with regards to the idea that Saudi is dumping this money because they're going to be exposed, I mean, even that is a much more complicated story. One of the things that Saudi Arabia is preparing for, much less protesting, is the idea that if they are sued for 9/11, then their U.S. assets will be confiscated and they will not be able to divest themselves of their U.S. assets. So this would just be a preparatory move for that, more so than a threat. But even regardless, the idea that this will crash the dollar is highly dubious, because over the past 20 months, China has divested itself of $780 billion of U.S. treasuries, and the U.S. treasury market is still going strong. So it is possible to absorb such a shock. The full treasury market is $15 trillion. So a lot of that is hype and spin, but all of this is directed towards really a type of geopolitical warfare that's going on right now between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. This has always been the implanted little bit in the 9/11 story that they censored, they covered up, they put in the classified 28 pages, and they told everyone, hey, look, these are the classified 28 pages you can't see about foreign involvement. And at the time, everyone everywhere was reporting it was Saudi Arabia. They're covering up Saudi Arabia. It's about Saudi Arabia. I remember seeing those reports on CBC News back 14 years ago, whenever the report first came out. I have a front page magazine article from July 2003 that links to the New York Post that it is every single aspect of the story that 60 Minutes is now reporting on was all there in 2003 in mainstream publications. Why is it coming out now? Why in this way? Why is there a full forecourt press about it? And why are we suddenly now being directed to hate Saudi Arabia? This is clearly about geopolitical machinations, not about 9/11 truth. I have been noting the growing rift between Saudi Arabia and the United States over the last few years, and I've been talking about this on the podcast periodically from time to time, saying that there is a wedge being driven between Saudi Arabia and the U.S., and of course their alliance is the backbone of the petrodollar, which has been one of the fundamental underlying parts of the U.S. dollar hegemony since the gold standard was taken off in the 1970s, since Nixon dechained the dollar, and what has been one of the fundamental things propping it up is this petrodollar, which is based on that U.S.-Saudi alliance that was first really cemented during World War II and has only expanded since then. And of course, with the machinations of people like Kissinger in the 70s, really compounded into what it is today. There is a rift that's been growing for years now. This is part of a geopolitical back and forth cat and mouse that's being played right now with Saudi Arabia seeing the writing on the wall in a number of ways, one of which is that a couple of years ago, China became the world's largest oil importer. So Saudi Arabia's real bread is going to be buttered in China, assuming oil is going to continue to be their bread and butter. But even that, longer term, is not going to be the case. And that's why Saudi Arabia is now talking about selling off part of Saudi Aramco and creating this $2 trillion slush fund that they can use to try to transition the country off of oil. In a number of ways, the fundamental alliance between U.S. and Saudi Arabia that's existed for decades is shifting. And I think the U.S. is trying to keep that stick and say, hey, guys, you better not get too far out from under our umbrella because we can hit you with this stick at any time. Mm-hmm. And that's why back a few years ago when I was reporting on this, I did a story called 9/11, the CIA and the Art of the Hangout, mm-hmm. where we talked about, again, at the time, this 28 pages and the information about these two alleged hijackers who allegedly hijacked Flight 77, which allegedly hit the Pentagon, around which all of this 28-page nonsense is revolving. At the time, I interviewed Kevin Ryan about it, and he called it, I think brilliantly, get into Saudi Arabia free card. Mm-hmm. That's what this 28 pages is about. That's why you've got Bob Graham and Porter Goss and all of these Congress critters who helped participate in the 9/11 cover-up coming out about this. And that's why this is really not about 9/11 truth. It is about having the potential to have, if not outright warfare, at least a type of geopolitical or financial warfare against Saudi Arabia in order to keep them in line. There's so many things to point out here. I mean, one of which, yes, okay, 15 of the 19 alleged hijackers, again, Saudis, were coming through with Saudi passports. But let's take one aspect of that. Where did the majority of those 15 get their visa to enter the United States? It was at the Jeddah Consulate. And I've interviewed J. Michael Springman a couple of times, who worked at the Jeddah Consulate back in the late 1980s, back during the Soviet-Afghan War, when Osama bin Laden was the U.S. golden boy. And he was constantly denying people visas to enter the country because they didn't meet the basic requirements. They couldn't say why they were going, how long they were going to be there, where they were going to be staying, what they wanted to do in the United States. So he would reject their visa applications, and that rejection would be overruled by people above him in the consulate there. Eventually, he got the inside skinny on some of the machinations that was going on there. There were CIA agents in the consulate, as there usually are in embassies and consulates around the world, that were overriding him because, again, Osama bin Laden was their golden boy in Afghanistan, and they were bringing bin Laden men over to the U.S. for training so that then they could ship them back to Afghan to fight those damn Ruskies. That was going on at the Jeddah Consulate in the 1980s. Lo and behold, a decade or so later, you have all of these 9/11 alleged hijackers getting their visas at that very consulate through a Visa Express program that was put in place explicitly just a few months before 9/11 that waived all the usual types of requirements and paperwork that these people would need so that they could just get straight into the country and get caught up in the 9/11 plot in whatever sense that was running. I mean, that's just one of the layers of this story. The other is that you look at the 60 Minutes report on the 28 pages, for example, they're pointing to this Fahad al-Thumairi character who's related to the Saudi embassy or consulate on the West Coast there in the United States, who was apparently linked to these two alleged hijackers, Al-Maidar and Al-Hazmi, who were staying there in Los Angeles, the first two of the alleged hijackers who got into the U.S. And they're saying, oh, look, there's this Saudi connection, and look at this other Saudi funder who was there with them, neglecting to mention Abdu Sattar Sheikh, who was an FBI informant from 94 to 2003, that these two hijackers, the alleged hijackers, were living with during their time in the United States. And the official story is, yes, okay, this guy was an FBI informant, but he didn't tell his FBI handler, Stephen Butler, he didn't tell them anything about these two guys. He just mentioned them by first name, just in casual passing. He didn't think they were a threat, so he didn't pass along that information. Just like the CIA didn't pass along the information to the FBI that these two people were coming into the country. Just like the NSA didn't tell anyone that they had recorded meetings of these two alleged hijackers in Malaysia, meeting with other known Al-Qaeda agents the year before. All of these things, all of this information didn't get out somehow. Again, all swirling around, and now we're getting just one thread of that, which is, hey, look at this Saudi connection to these guys. Look at these Saudi handlers. Look at the Saudi money. Don't look at any of the other connections or surrounding context that would problematize that story. And then again, of course, the bigger question is, who are these guys? Were they hijackers at all? And how do we know that? And what actually happened on 9/11? Of course, none of this is going to be brought out. It's all going to come back down to what they already have implanted in this story, which is that it was the Saudis. And it wasn't even the Saudis knowingly trying to commit or help in this terrorist attack. It was just that they were funding these Al-Qaeda guys. So it ended up turning into 9/11. And there's an even other layer of this onion. I hate to complicate it this much, but this is the craziness we're dealing with. Richard Clark, a couple of years ago, came out and was saying CIA Director George Tenet was keeping information from him, as national security counterterrorism czar, was keeping information from him about these two alleged hijackers. And he was putting that blame on George Tenet. And his theory was that the CIA was trying to flip these two guys. They were trying to recruit them, but it got out of control and they went out and did the 9/11 plot. And, you know, lo and behold, just another intelligence failure. And again, what's the ultimate solution to a problem like that? Give these intelligence agencies more power, more money, more power, more control, more funding so that they can properly do these missions and properly communicate with each other and share all their data that the NSA is snarfling up through their data centers. So ultimately, in every way, this benefits the establishment and the system and the inside cronies. And unless and until I see some orange jumpsuits on Bush and Cheney and all the neocons and all the intelligence operatives in all of the places that were helping in 9/11, I'm going to say that this is nothing more and nothing less than a limited hangout.
Here he's asked about what would happen if the bill before Congress that would allow victims' family members to sue officials of Saudi Arabia for 9/11, if this bill is passed.
Well, if it does pass again, the Saudis would pretty much be expected to sell as much of their U.S.-held assets as they can, because, again, all of that would be confiscated and confiscatable in the event of a successful lawsuit against them. So that would be the expected outcome of that. I mean, depending how it's done, if they dump it all at one time on the U.S. Treasury market, that would cause havoc and could severely affect the dollar. But assuming they try to do it in a way that's somewhat more of an orderly divestment, it could be easily absorbed by the $15 trillion treasury market. So again, that's speculation. But really, I think what's going on here is it's Uncle Sam holding the pit bull, the attack pit bull, and saying, oh, look at this attack pit bull. If I let go of this leash, she's going to come get you. I think that's what's happening here, which is why I don't think that this bill is probably going to pass. There's enough of propaganda that's been thrown out there by now that something of some sort has to eventuate from this, whether that's diplomatically. It might even be the declassification of the 28 pages. We might actually see that, but not the going ahead of the lawsuit. I could imagine that scenario because even Saudi Arabia has in the past said, declassify those 28 pages. We want to see what's in them too. Because what's ultimately going to be found in there is not the specific connections that will tie it back, as I say, to the CIA and FBI and NSA and all the other alphabet supers that were involved in this. It's going to be kind of nebulous. Oh, well, there was some money that came from these people. You know, it was just because they were funding all these different people and organizations that they knew was linked to terror, but they didn't know what was going on. That's the extent that I expect this hangout to go to. And maybe a few heads will roll, but none of the important ones. And as I say, nothing will come back to any of the people that we know on the inside who had to have been involved in this plot. And of course, all of this diverts all the attention away from any of the other aspects of what 9/11 Truth talks about or has identified over the years. All of the, I mean, did Saudi Arabia coordinate the drills that were going on in that morning? Were they running Able Danger and able to somehow stop Able Danger from going forward with its investigation into people like Mohammed Atta? Were they running a PTEC and that was working on the interoperability of the Pentagon and the FAA on the morning of 9/11? Were they involved in all of these other things? Were they rigging WTC-7 to go down? I mean, there's so much more to this story, and now we're being asked to concentrate on this 28 pages as if that's the whole clue to the entire 9/11 puzzle.
And here he's asked for advice about where he thinks this will all go and how the 9/11 truth movement should be responding to this effort to redact the 28 pages.
Well, as with any limited hangout, there will still be something put forward out there. And even if it is only the sense in the public that, hey, wow, there really has been something that's been covered up for the last 15 years that's only coming out now because of political pressure, I mean, even the most brainwashed of the brainwashed will be able to understand that there's something fundamentally wrong with the entire system and the process if that is able to happen. So if this does come out, if the pages are declassified and if there is more coverage of that, yes, it will only go a very short distance towards 9/11 truth, but it is at least the potential foot in the door for a larger conversation about that. And I hope that people in the alt media and people who support the alt media will be ready and willing and able to get that information out there and inject it into the mainstream conversation. I mean, over the past decade that you and I have been doing this, I know I've seen it, I'm sure you've seen it from your perspective, the alt media has made incredible inroads in the general conversation that's happening in society to the point where people understand what a false flag event is, even if they don't believe 9/11 was one. We have made some progress with that. I think there's a lot more progress that we can make, and we can use stories like this to leverage some real truth about 9/11. So if it's, I don't know, I mean, sharing the 9/11 conspiracy theory video, if you like that video, share that out and say, hey, they've lied to us about 9/11 for 15 years. What else are they keeping from us? I mean, that's the potential good point of this. And I think we have to use that leverage to try to get the real truth about 9/11 out there.
And again, that was James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com. So to sum it up, the Joint Congressional Inquiry was a cover-up investigation. It didn't question the government version of events, but was only tasked with looking into intelligence failures on 9/11. It was run by insiders like Senator Bob Graham and Porter Goss, who later became director of the CIA. Not mentioned by the speakers today is the fact that because of a leak from the Joint Congressional Inquiry, the FBI created a dossier on every member of the Joint Inquiry. So while the Joint Inquiry was investigating the FBI was investigating the Joint Inquiry. I don't need to tell you what that kind of setup could do to anyone who may have actually wanted to get at the truth. And all the hype about the Saudi involvement in 9/11, in addition to being used to manipulate the Saudis, is also a perfect way to get most Americans believing the Saudis did 9/11 while distracting from the real perpetrators of 9/11, like the neocons and their puppets and co-conspirators in our own government. When this whole throw the Saudis under the bus strategy makes it to 60 Minutes and other corporate media outlets, you know something's up. You know it's manipulation of some kind. And what it looks like to me is that the Saudi card was played using these 28 redacted pages and the new bill in Congress that would allow family members to sue the Saudis, throwing out their diplomatic immunity. They used these to twist the Saudis' arms. And it looks like it worked to me, because I just read an article in the New York Times that the Saudis have just restructured their government, throwing out some old-timers and bringing in new people. The article also mentioned that they privatized some government departments. And that's a sign that the neocons were behind this with their neoliberal agenda to put public money in their own private, for-profit hands. Also, the tone of the attacks on the Saudis has softened and changed. Now some of the 9/11 commissioners are saying that all of the information in those 28 redacted pages is actually in the 9/11 commission report. So let's not let this psychological operation around these 28 redacted pages from a cover-up report run by insiders with CIA connections and not worth the paper it was printed on distract us from the real evidence concerning what really happened on 9/11. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Power to the people!
their slumber. All you wage slaves, everyone.
The revolution comes like thunder, and the age of hypocrisy is done.
Turn off their televised illusion.
This is a Building Bridges special presented by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
And now get your signs ready to bring to the rally for $15 in a union, our next stop in Building Bridges.
But first, a word of complaint about her wages. I mean, who knew? From the world's most prominent nanny, Mary Poppins.
Mary Poppins?
I'm afraid I'm leaving for good this time, children.
But why?
Hold this. I'm only paid the federal minimum wage. See?
But you have magical powers.
You'd think that would entitle me to more than $7.25 an hour.
Please don't leave this choice position. We will die of malnutrition.
Jane, don't be dramatic. In every job that must be done, you must be paid in more than fun. You get your paycheck and snap. Federal and state income tax, Medicare and Social Security? Why, you're living below the poverty line. And every job you start to do can quickly go askew. The pay's too low. I can't live on this dough. Just a $3 increase can make a living wage. It makes a living wage. It makes a living wage. Just a $3 increase can make a living wage. I don't get these birds for free. A penguin hopping off to work is feeling like a stupid jerk. He can't even buy some fish to feed his kids. He takes a second job at night. The penguin parents start to fight. They're broke, they smoke, their college fund's a joke. Just a $3 increase can make a living wage. It makes a living wage. It makes a living wage. Just a $3 increase can make a living wage. I still don't get these birds for free. The CEOs...
Well, so Mary Poppins, thanks for weighing in. And she's joining the movement for 15 and a union. Who knew? Well, we're off with Mary Poppins to the rally. Fast food, home care, child care, airport, higher education, hospital, and other underpaid workers in the biggest ever day of global strikes and protests demand $15 an hour and union rights for workers everywhere.
The workers and their supporters swept the country in protest to demand corporations pay workers wages they can live on and that giant corporations like McDonald's pay their fair share of taxes. The workers zeroed in on McDonald's, the world's second largest employer and industry leader, as a symbol of what is wrong with the economy.
Around the world, workers rallied in more than 40 countries on six continents, including a blockade at the McDonald's in Disneyland Paris, protests in the United Kingdom against zero-hour contracts, which fail to guarantee workers a minimum number of hours, protests in Korea against unpaid hours and unsafe working conditions, and a series of marches against unfair labor practices in Brazil.
In New York, where workers already won $15, the rally focuses on the demand for union rights and supporting the call for 15 by workers all across the country. After the rally, workers will march from McDonald's, where the fight for 15 started more than 3 years ago, to a $1,000 a plate GOP gala protesting against Donald Trump, who opposed raising wages.
Let's go to the rally.
Fight for 15! This is our fight for 15! And I work at McDonald's. Yay! We all gonna get $15 now, whoever's not making a living wage.
Yeah!
In 2012, a bunch of fast food workers all came together, wanted for $15 in the union, right? So fast food workers said, enough is enough. So we went out and we said, enough is enough. And we beat those streets. Everything in New York, around the country, around the world, everybody's looking to us on how do we do it? How do we do it?
Organize!
By sticking together. How do we do it? We're winning. Who's winning?
We are.
Whose streets?
Our streets.
Whose streets?
Our streets.
Whose streets?
Our streets.
Whose country?
Our country.
That's right. It's time for us to take it back, correct? Now, I want to introduce an airport worker who the 515 is in solidarity with. And I want everybody to give him a round of applause. His name is Mike Carey.
32! I'm a security officer from Aviation Safeguard at Terminal 7. And I've been in this fight for over 3 years. We're finally there. $15, what can we say? I mean, $15 is awesome. Nothing beats that money. But I want you to put this energy, I want you to put this fight in getting a union. We all have the protection behind us. $15 is great. But without the union, without 32BJ, and the support and the protection, believe me, it might not come off. So, of course, we are great for the 15. We're going to clap our hands for the $15. But let's push this fight now for a union. 32! 32! Thank you very much.
But here, we're here today to make things change. And things are changing, right? You know why they're changing? Because we're staying together. We're saying enough is enough. We're not turning out the cheek no more. We're going to do something about our problem. What are we going to do? All right. Another person I want to speak about, Antonio Abreu. He's from Workers United. Because we all need to get united. Everybody give him a round of applause. Workers United. Antonio!
Trabajando en un laundry industrial.
I have 12 years working in an industrial laundry.
Y gano un salario más bajo que 10 años atrás.
And I make a salary less than 10 years ago.
Porque el dueño del laundry hizo un repartimiento de las horas extra por distribución en tiempo part-time.
Because the worker has been cutting hours and has put most of the workers part-time.
Teníamos 2 años sin seguro médico.
We had 2 years without health care.
Porque quiero comidas en la mesa.
Because I want to put food on the table.
Quiero una mejor educación para mis hijos.
I want a better education for my kids.
Los empresarios evaden las responsabilidades. No quieren pagar salario justo.
The companies don't want to pay a just salary.
Y hoy le exhortamos a todos que nos unamos para exigir mejores condiciones salariales.
And I'm asking all of you to unite together to make sure we continue this fight to win better salaries for everyone.
Porque si no nos unimos, no lo lograremos.
If we don't unite, we won't be able to meet the aim.
Digan junto conmigo, ¡sí se puede! ¡Sí se puede! ¡Sí se puede!
¡Sí se puede!
Fight for 15 is in 300 cities, 40 countries, and 6 continents. In 2002, we were just in New York City. Amazing.
But the fight, it's just begun.
Can we do it?
Yes, we can.
Can we do it?
Yes, we can.
Can we do it?
Yes, we can.
My next guest, Joel Berg from Hunger Free America.
No one in America should go hungry, right?
No!
Should people working full-time, 1 or 2 or 3 jobs, go hungry?
No!
Now, for my conservative friends who oppose us when we say low-income people need food stamps, SNAP benefits, they say you should work. I say, why the heck do you then oppose minimum wage increases? And for the wealthy executives at McDonald's and elsewhere who say they just can't afford to do this, I say if they can't afford their golden arches anymore because they pay their workers enough to feed their families, we'll chip in for some bronze arches, won't we?
Yeah.
everyone working should have the dignity and the money in their pocket to buy the food they believe their family needs. When you guys started this just a few years ago, they said, you're crazy, you're loco, you're nuts. You'll never get 15. That's nearly double. But you prove people power triumphs over money power. You proved will matters. So we are celebrating this great victory today, thanking the workers, thanking the unions, but saying we won't be satisfied until 15 and raising for inflation is the law everywhere in the country. We have no more hunger in America because everyone working full-time can feed their family with their wages.
This next worker is a prime example of how the 515 is like a domino effect for all workers. Her name is Bianca Cunningham, and she's on strike for Verizon. Let's give her a round of applause, everybody.
My name is Bianca Cunningham, and I stand here before you today representing retail workers at Verizon Wireless. 2 years ago, after enduring sexual harassment, bullying from our management, seeing our commissions shrink, seeing our wages stagnated, we were fed up. And we saw the landline workers at Verizon enjoying benefits and job security. And we knew the only reason they were enjoying this was because of their union and because they weren't afraid to take it to the streets and demand better from these greedy companies like Verizon. People told us we were crazy and that a retail job could never see a union, but we silenced the haters when we stood together to join the Communication Workers of America. We have been at the bargaining table for the last 2 years, and our demands are modest. All we want them to do is recognize our union and to earn a living wage to live in this city. They refuse to hear our voices, so now we are on strike with our landline brothers and sisters in the streets telling them, can they hear us now? We are fighting for our first contract. Not too long ago, people said $15 an hour was crazy, that it would never happen. And again, those same haters were silenced, and we banded together and won. We have $15 an hour, but we know that we can't stop there. Every job should be a union job.
Yes!
We deserve a voice on our job. We deserve job security, and we deserve accountability from management. The only way we could do this is if we all stick together. Let's remind them that New York is a union town. Thank you.
This next person I'm calling up, she's a good friend from the 515, Carlene Pinto, New York Immigration Coalition.
And we represent over 200 organizations that support immigrant communities through the state. And as we know, the negative xenophobic rhetoric being shouted at our people is at an all-time low, and we need to stand up together, whether it be for $15 in a union, whether it be to make sure DACA and DAPA comes out of the Supreme Court in June, which would mean that 5 million immigrants that have been here for over a decade would be able to get a working permit in the United States. Yeah. We know that us in this battle for $15 has been a long, hard battle, and it's only the beginning, because we know that we deserve $22 or more for the labor we put in a city where our cost of living is astronomical. We are mobilizing 700 people to Washington, D.C. to call out the Supreme Court and the Republican Party to lift the injunction that's keeping 250,000 New Yorkers from having access to working papers and pathways to citizenship. I tell you all that your vote is your voice, and whether you're a brother or sister locked up in a jail cell, or whether you're a brother or sister that's undocumented and living in the shadows, we must be their voices today, tomorrow, next year, and forever. Balance siempre, balance!
Hector,
Nicaragua.
That's the SEIU, 32 BJ.
and it called for the country to follow New York on the halls of justice, we are going to win 15 nationally because we won 15 in New York. When we started this fight in 2012, fast food workers went on strike here in New York City demanding 15 and a union. And there were many who said that will be impossible. Look at where we are today. We have increased the pay for 70 million workers around the country. We have won 15 for over 10 million workers in the country. And yes, brothers and sisters, the fight for 15 will also be the fight for the union. So to those who say that McDonald's, Burger King, Domino Pizza, all of the fast food companies, they will never be union, we say to them today what we said to those who said that 15 was impossible. We will win the union for fast food workers. But the true champions of this movement are all of you and the workers. You have raised your voice, and those who are there in government who care about the issues, like Governor Cuomo, Speaker Hastie, then your state legislature, listen, and now we have our minimum wage. I'm not going to read the whole message because we need to be ready to march to join those who are going to protest somebody who claims that he can be president, but he doesn't care about 15, he doesn't care about unity, he doesn't care about this country, he only cares about getting to power. We are going to march later from here, fighting for 15, to denounce and rally against that candidate in the Republican Party who wants to build a wall. So brothers and sisters, are you ready to fight for 15 throughout the country? Are you ready to keep on striking if that's what it takes?
My name is Javier Espinoza. I'm a CWA, Local 111 member. Fight for 15. You guys did it. You guys won $15 minimum wage here in New York State. You got 15 because you wanted 15. If you want 20, you can get 20. You put your minds to it, and you accomplished it. Right now, all across this country, there are rallies taking place just like this one because of you. Your victory has inspired others to fight for a fair minimum wage, for a quality lifestyle, for a piece of that American dream. If you unite together, you fight together, there isn't any battle that you can't win. You are an inspiration to me and to my union brothers and sisters at CWA. We are on a fight right now. We are on strike against corporate greed, against Verizon right now. We're in a struggle, and we're in a fight, and we need everyone's help. Verizon wants to devalue our jobs that we have right now. They want to strip down our contract. But we're not going to do that. We're not going to take that. Because the more we lower ourselves, we let you down. We're going to hold the front against Verizon and corporate greed. With one hand, we're going to stop them. And with our other hand, we're going to reach down and we're going to pick people up and make you like us. I was told that I can end this speech in an angry way or a positive way. I'm not going to go down the angry route because I'm not interested in corporate pigs and executives that only care about their mansions, their yachts, their million-dollar salaries. I'm interested in me, my family. I'm interested in us, the legs that society and this economy stand on. We make this country work. Together as a union, as brothers and sisters,
We have shown that when we fight and we are united, we can win. We want a $15 minimum wage. Now it's time to fight for more. It's time to get that 20. It's time to fight for the right to organize, to unionize. It's time to fight for fair contracts. It's time to put down corporate greed in America.
American Association of New York. Congratulations on 15. We are standing together, fighting for 15, but also saying that economic justice equals immigrant justice equals racial justice. This morning, we stood with the family of Akai Gurley because the fight for 15 cares about Black Lives Matter. Oftentimes, the Muslim community and the Arab community is invisible in the fight for 15. And not only are we dealing with Islamophobia in the United States and war being waged on our people and us being surveilled, but 45% of Muslim Americans in the United States live under the poverty line and only make $30,000 a year. So we are here standing for our community, but standing with all communities. Because our struggles are connected. The fight for 15 is not just a fight in New York. It's not a fight nationally. It's a global fight for human rights and for human dignity. So it's time for us to stand together and demand justice and dignity together. Because this country is wealthy with resources, but these resources are not trickling down to everybody. They are not coming down to our communities. So we are still suffering and we won't stop. Today is one step and it's one victory, but it's just one day in the struggle for justice for all of us. And we will not stop until there is freedom and dignity for our community, for your community, for my community, for all of us.
Buenas tardes, compañeros y compañeras. Mi nombre es Eduardo Redwood y pertenezco a NICE, compañeros.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Eduardo Redwood and I am part of NICE.
Pertenezco, compañeros, a la organización de NICE, a lo que organizamos a los jornaleros de la parada número 69 de Queens.
We're part of New Immigrant Community Empowerment, NICE, and we work with day laborers from the day labor stop on 69th Street, Queens. Woo!
Estamos tratando, compañeros, con los jornaleros de que no salgan a trabajar si no nos pagan $15, compañeros, porque lamentablemente lo que ganamos nosotros solo nos alcanza para pagar renta, compañeros.
We're trying to organize day laborers so that we don't go for jobs less than $15 an hour. We're here trying to make rent too.
Yes. Solo quería decirles, compañeros, que la unión hace la fuerza y si luchamos todos vamos a lograr que se nos paguen los $15.
Just want to say that unity gives us power, and we're going to be in this fight till we get 15.
Solo un grito, compañeros. ¡Sí se puede!
¡Sí se puede! ¡Sí se puede! ¡Sí se puede!
Thank you.
When I say worker, you say power. Worker!
Power!
Worker!
Yo sé que no estoy sola porque yo estoy con todos ustedes.
This fight is not just about a wage. It's about living a real life. A life with health, dignity, and justice. It's about not having to choose between getting a checkup and paying your rent. It's about not having to choose between reproductive health care and supporting your family. It's about living in a society where our fundamental human rights are respected and guaranteed. That's the kind of society that we're fighting for. That's We are the 99%. We deserve everything in this society that they have to give, and we're not going to stop until we get it. Latinas are tired. We're tired of being undervalued. We're tired of being underappreciated. And we're tired being the punching bag for racist politicians who want to build walls, and they want to use our families and our communities as a punching bag. And they want to blame all of the country's problems on our families and our communities. We say no. They want border walls and division. But the worker struggle has no borders. The worker struggle has no borders. And so we are hopeful, we are energized, and we are powerful. Si se puede. Si se puede. Si se puede. Si se puede. Si se puede.
And you've been listening to a rally celebrating the fight for 15 minimum wage and the road ahead for unions for all and much, much more.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
The vote kept changing. Mr. Speaker, from a parliamentary perspective, how is that possible?
I think it was the most intimidating moment of my entire life, is standing up in front of a parish hall full of people and coming out to them and answering questions about what it meant to be trans. That was very difficult. By Tuesday afternoon, there were media folks from the local television stations kind of camped out in front of my house, hoping to get a view.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell.
An international celebration of LGBT rights fights phobias, U.S. House Republicans vote for discrimination, and the transfiguration of an Episcopal transition. Those stories and more this week, because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news interaffecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending May 21st, 2016. The 12th Annual International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia, and Biphobia, formerly known by the acronym IDAHO and now IDAHOT, was observed around the world on May 17th. According to the organizing committee, the day is now celebrated in more than 130 countries, including 37 where private consensual adult same-gender sex is a crime. The May 17th date was chosen for the first IDAHO in 2004 to mark the day in 1990 that the World Health Organization removed homosexuality from its list of mental disorders. A statement issued ahead of IDAHOT by several human rights bodies called on all governments to follow the World Health Organization's example and depathologize homosexuality. It was co-signed by the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, and the Commissioner for Human Rights of the Council of Europe. Bisexual Scottish actor Alan Cumming hosted the UN's first ever LGBTI gala the night before on May 16th. While he praised the world body for observing IDAHOT, he told the Associated Press that it was also kind of ridiculous at the same time that this is the first time anything like this has happened at the UN.
Several hundred people hit the streets of Kosovo, guarded by a heavy police presence, for the second annual Pride Parade, marking the International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia, and Biphobia in the Balkan state. The marchers included Kosovo's president and deputy foreign minister and the U.S. and British ambassadors.
Cuban President Raul Castro's straight but not narrow daughter Mariela, the island nation's most visible LGBT rights advocate, led Havana's largest ever pride parade to mark IDAHOT on May 15th and then led a similar but smaller observance on May 17th in the Cuban city of Matanzas.
Russian activists risked arrest by holding an IDAHOT flash mob in St. Petersburg on May 17th. More than 40 people from several groups, including Coming Out and the Side-by-Side LGBT Film Festival, gathered at the unauthorized demonstration. If police had arrived before the flash mob dispersed, the participants could have been detained for violating Russia's infamous no-promo homo law.
The largest ever LGBT rights event was held in Uganda on the same day. Thanks to both government and religious leaders, with a major assist from frequently visiting U.S. evangelical cure peddlers, overwhelming bias against sexual and gender minorities is woven into Uganda's national culture. Mindful of the possible consequences of attempting a pride march down the streets of Kampala, organizers instead put together an IDAHOT observance along the shores of nearby Lake Victoria. The day included food and drink, performances on a rainbow-bedecked stage, and beach games. Happily, authorities let the unauthorized event go on, and there were no disruptions or arrests.
But 10 activists were arrested at the break of dawn on May 17th in the former Soviet nation of Georgia for spray-painting "All Love is Equal" on the fence of the Georgian Orthodox Patriarch's office. The church has been a strident opponent of LGBT rights. Police said the activists are facing charges ranging from vandalism to disobeying police orders, but there were no reported injuries.
In other news, Bolivia's Chamber of Deputies passed legislation on May 19th that would allow trans people to change their gender and name on official documents. The South American nation's Deputy Justice Minister, Diego Jimenez, strongly supports the measure, noting that Bolivia's constitution prohibits all forms of discrimination based on gender or sexual orientation. The gender identity bill still needs Senate approval and the signature of President Evo Morales. If Morales eventually signs the bill, trans people will nonetheless be required to first apply to the Ministry of Justice for an ill-defined psychological examination of some sort before they can legally change their identity.
Denmark's government is running out of patience with the World Health Organization regarding its continued classification of transgender people as mentally ill. Gender identity disorder, the medical term used to define transgender people, is currently listed as a mental condition in the WHO's International Classification of Diseases. Even though the global medical body removed homosexuality from that list in 1990, WHO officials say only that they're continuing to assess the situation regarding trans people. Denmark is a longtime leader in its progressive treatment of transgender citizens. Health Minister Sophie Lode told reporters this week that her government intends to declassify transgender people as mentally ill by itself early next year if the World Health Organization hasn't made the change by then.
Lesbians in Portugal will soon have access to artificial insemination and other fertility services. Until now, those services have only been available to married heterosexual couples who've lived together for more than 2 years. The Associated Press reports that lawmakers in the European nation also approved changes to relevant laws involving surrogacy, giving lesbians that option, but only if the woman has health problems preventing pregnancy. Portuguese lawmakers opened civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples in 2010. The latest changes are due to take effect within the next few weeks. Left-of-center parties gained a parliamentary majority in elections at the end of last year. The same majority also recently passed legislation removing some restrictions on abortion and allowing same-gender couples to adopt children.
A group of 51 Muslim countries blocked several LGBT organizations from attending an important HIV/AIDS conference at the United Nations scheduled for next month. Egypt wrote to the president of the General Assembly on behalf of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, objecting to the participation of those groups. According to a Reuters report, the letter gave no specific reason for the objections, but the Islamic group's anti-LGBT positions are well documented. Earlier this year, it joined the 54-member African group and the 25-member Group of Friends of the Family that includes Belarus, Egypt, and Qatar to protest the UN's 6 new postage stamps promoting LGBT equality. UN ambassadors from the US, the EU, Canada, and Australia all slammed the decision. Critics say that it will prevent activist groups that include African Men for Sexual Health and Rights, Ishtar Men Who Have Sex with Men, and the Asia-Pacific Transgender Network from attending. Pink News reported that queer-friendly NGOs from Egypt, Thailand, Kenya, Guyana, Jamaica, Peru, and Ukraine have also been banned. According to the Associated Press, at least one U.S.-based group, Global Action for Trans Equality, is also not welcome to what is being billed as a major gathering aimed at formulating new ways to fight the worldwide pandemic. It's scheduled for June 8th and 9th at the UN headquarters in New York City.
In other news, police in Bangladesh have arrested an Islamic militant for the brutal murders of 2 LGBT rights activists. Jules Hasmanan, who edited the country's only LGBT publication, and Mahbub Tanoi, a college student and fellow activist, were found shot and slashed to death in an apartment in Dhaka in April. Police said this week that 37-year-old suspect Shariful Islam Sihab is a member of the Ansarullah Bangla team, which has been blamed for the murders of academics as well as religious and sexual minorities. Several members of the same group were convicted last year for killing an atheist blogger. Sihab reportedly admitted supplying one of the 2 guns used in the murders, but denied being one of the 6 men who are believed to have been involved in the bloody assassinations.
In happier news, the United States has its first openly gay Secretary of the Army. Eric Fanning was already the highest-ranking out member of the Department of Defense. After months of delay by one obstructionist senator who finally relented, a single member can block a presidential nomination for any reason under the archaic rules of the chamber. The U.S. Senate confirmed Fanning in a unanimous voice vote on May 17th. President Obama submitted Fanning's nomination last September. But until this week, Republican Senator Pat Roberts of Kansas had placed a hold on the nomination in a totally unrelated dispute over Obama administration plans to close the facility at Guantanamo Bay and transfer dangerous terrorists to maximum security prisons in the U.S. No one, not even Roberts, questioned Fanning's credentials. He's held jobs with several branches of the U.S. military for the past several years. He served as Air Force Undersecretary and Deputy Chief Management Officer and Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy. The 47-year-old Fanning most recently served as Acting Undersecretary of the Army. He's been a close civilian advisor to Defense Secretary Ash Carter, who said he was proud to swear Fanning in soon after the vote.
And finally, President Barack Obama is reportedly soon to declare the first ever U.S. national monument recognizing the struggle for LGBT rights. The Stonewall Inn, in the heart of New York City's Greenwich Village, was considered a dive bar in June 1969. Two nights of rock-throwing rebellion against a routine police raid late that month sparked America's modern queer liberation movement. City officials are apparently still investigating the history of the land title. But, barring any last-minute complications, President Obama is expected to declare the Stonewall Inn and its nearby surroundings a national monument and part of the National Park Service, just in time for next month's traditional U.S. LGBT Pride celebrations.
That's News Wrap for the week ending May 21st, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
In a late-breaking News Wrap update, Bolivia's gender identity bill was unexpectedly approved in quick order by the Senate and signed into law by Vice President Alvaro Garcia Linera on May 21st. President Evo Morales was on state business in Havana at the time. The new law allowing trans people to change their name and gender on official government documents is one of the most progressive trans-related laws in the region.
I couldn't stand to see people that I love go through this.
Crucified in the press and buried in the pulpit, a trans priest rises again later in the program. It was Robert's Rules of Chaos in the U.S. House of Representatives on May 19th when the right to discriminate against people on the basis of religious beliefs came to the floor. Out Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney of New York offered an amendment to strike a stipulation from a major defense spending bill that grants that right to religious corporations, associations, and institutions that receive federal contracts.
This bill writes anti-gay bias into federal law. It strips LGBT Americans of basic workplace protections by reversing the president's anti-discrimination orders, saying it is once again legal for your LGBT neighbors and family members to be fired because of who they are. This is wrong. This is not about supporting our troops. It's not about fighting ISIS. It's not about religious protections. We can do all that, and we should. This is about bigotry, plain and simple. When my husband and I got married after waiting 22 years, so many of you expressed your support. Will you now look me in the eye and say it would be okay for me to lose my job over it?
Pacifica Radio's Mark Miracle reports on what happened soon thereafter.
On this vote, the ayes are 212, the nays are 213. The amendment is not adopted.
Shouts of shame, shame, shame erupted in the House of Representatives as Republican lawmakers narrowly defeated legislation to protect the civil rights of LGBT employees of government contractors. According to the count in the House chamber, the measure, an amendment to a veterans and military construction spending bill, initially had enough yes votes to pass, but ultimately it failed by one vote. House Republican leaders extended the time allowed for the vote as they urged enough party members to change their positions to defeat it by a vote of 213 to 212.
Mr. Speaker.
House Democratic Whip Steny Hoyer of Maryland.
I want to raise a parliamentary inquiry initially with reference to the fact that Mr. Ryan, our Speaker, has told us if people were in the well that the vote would be held open. I was standing in the well. No one came or no one had the courage to come into the well to change their vote. But notwithstanding that, the vote kept changing. Mr. Speaker, from a parliamentary perspective, how is that possible?
The chair was entertaining requests for changes.
I saw no one come to the desk to change their vote, Mr. Speaker.
Does the gentleman have a parliamentary inquiry?
The parliamentary inquiry is, how can the vote change when no one comes to the well to change their vote.
The chair had not yet announced the request for changes.
I didn't hear the chair request change, but I do know that from my own personal observation, not one of those members who apparently changed their vote because it kept changing on the board came to this well and had the courage to change from green to red or red to green. How is that possible, Mr. Speaker?
Nancy Pelosi, the House Democratic leader, said in a statement, House Republicans are so committed to discriminating against LGBT Americans that they broke regular order to force their members to reverse their votes and support Republicans' bigotry. Republicans who backed the provision said it was necessary to protect the religious rights of military contractors and not intended to be discriminatory.
In early voting, Maloney's amendment was ahead by 6 votes, so 7 Republicans had to have changed their votes for the final one vote loss. According to a May 20th story in Capitol Hill's newspaper of record Roll Call, not just 7, but closer to 30 Republicans actually changed their votes on anti-LGBT bias. Only 29 GOP members voted for the Maloney amendment this week. 60 Republicans voted last year for a similar amendment upholding President Obama's ban on federal contractors practicing employment discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. Back then, before he assumed the typical non-voting role of House Speaker, Paul Ryan voted for the LGBT protections.
I'm Kate Clinton, and while I can joke about the political state of our country, it's no laughing matter what Congress could do to our civil rights.
Hi, I'm Cleve Jones, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
An informed community is a strong community.
Oh, Arkansas! Oh, Arkansas! Arkansas!
Fayetteville and some of the other cities have passed ordinances, and it shows that there is some progress in moving towards justice for all people.
We first met transgender activist Reverend Gwen Fry in April talking Arkansas politics, politics that becomes personal in this follow-up conversation with our Abby Dees.
2 years ago, Episcopal priest Gwen Fry came out publicly as a trans woman. And despite genuine support from within her church, a firestorm erupted beyond her imagining. The Reverend Gwen Fry had been the priest in charge for a year at Grace Episcopal Church in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, when everything changed.
Before I came out, I heard time and time again I was the best priest they ever had in the last 25 years. The day I came out and the day afterwards, I was a monster.
In 2012, gender identity and gender expression officially became part of the Episcopal Church's non-discrimination canon. This was the moment Gwen decided that she would start the journey to come out to her church and community. In February 2014, Gwen told her bishop and the vestry. She felt supported and encouraged by everyone. Well, almost.
There was one individual who, when I came out at the vestryman meeting, just turned to me and asked me, well, does this mean that you're going to be wearing curlers in your hair and have eyeshadow in the pulpit?
Because no woman would wear curlers in her hair in the pulpit. Well, that's a stupid question.
Exactly. But that was just kind of where right. They were coming from.
The bishop counseled a careful step-by-step approach to coming out to the whole parish, hoping to create time for reflection. And that was the plan, briefly. But word immediately leaked out, and that was it for baby steps.
So what the vestry asked me to do is to basically tell the entire parish at a special coffee hour on that next Sunday. And so that Sunday rolled around, and our average Sunday attendance was about 50. That Sunday, there were 90 in the pews. And with everything that was going on, I think it was the most intimidating moment of my entire life, is standing up in front of a parish hall full of people and coming out to them and answering questions about what it meant to be trans. That was difficult. That was very difficult.
After you did that, you said you got a lot of positive response from the parish. What form did that take?
them talking to folks who are upset, are concerned, not necessarily upset. Their support of me and my family to see how we were doing, mm-hmm. emails, telephone calls. They were really, really working hard to stay out in front of this momentum that was building. Unfortunately, even with their help, that never happened. The Monday morning after I came out to the parish, the local newspaper was calling the diocesan office and me for interviews and statements. Tuesday morning, it made the front page of the local paper. Mm. By Tuesday afternoon, there were media folks from the local television stations kind of camped out in front of my house, hoping to get a view. It was very, very difficult because my spouse was also a priest in a different parish. And at that point in time, we were concerned that she too would be losing her position over that. By Wednesday morning, I just saw that there was no way that I could get out in front of it. The parish was splitting up over this and breaking up. It was even into some of the families where spouses were kind of divided on this and children against their parents. And I couldn't stand to see people that I love go through this. And so I called the bishop on that Wednesday morning and I told him that he put me in the position and, you know, he had the ability and the authority to get me out. And so he did that. There was a special vestry meeting that Wednesday evening. He wrote a letter to the senior warden of the vestry and the vestry, which basically dissolved the pastoral relationship between myself and the parish. And that was the last time I walked out of that church building.
Did you feel at all supported by the diocese or people in positions of authority?
The bishop was extremely supportive. Perhaps not in a public way, but certainly quietly behind the scenes. For that, I am very grateful. Once this broke and once the blog sphere started picking up and running with this story, my trans friends, both within the Episcopal Church and in the general public, were very, very helpful and supportive of me and my family. If Facebook is an indicator, the couple of days after I lost my position, you know, there were folks from all around the world who were sending friend requests and things like that because they had heard what had happened. And that was quite powerful for me to see that I had that kind of support, not only locally and nationally, but with folks from around the world. That was nice.
I just want to be absolutely clear that I understand. It seems to me like you saw kind of an eruption. Did you initiate the idea that you had to leave, or was that going to happen anyway?
It was going to happen anyway. It had just gotten beyond anyone's control and took on a life of its own. I've painted the congregation in a negative light, and I don't want to do that. I chose to come out there and transition there because I truly did feel like there was a chance of having success and staying in that position because they are quite progressive. It was just different with their priest.
Did this do anything to your faith?
No.
Did your faith get you through this?
It most certainly did. Anyone who's been active in a religious tradition, especially clergy, knows that you cannot put your faith in the institution. You have to put your faith in God. I did that. It was very, very difficult those first few days. But after I lost my position, as a matter of fact, the day after that, a friend of mine from another local parish who did not know what had happened the evening before, just invited me to a church service. It was a 6 o'clock service in the evening, very accepting liturgy and group of people. I knew that I needed to go to church and reconnect with God. So I did, and late that afternoon I got dressed and I walked out of the house for the first time as Gwen to go to church. As if that wasn't powerful enough, when I got there and they read the gospel, it was the gospel reading of the Transfiguration, the last Sunday of the Epiphany, and it was like, oh my God. It was an overwhelming experience, and I was accepted by the folks there in that congregation, and so I've been there ever since.
This happened in, well, about just over 2 years ago. How did you survive? How did you get through?
The thing that got me through, to be really honest with you, were the friends that I had in Trans Episcopal, which is a transgender group within the Episcopal Church. And also, I didn't sleep a whole lot. But the thing that really helped me was I could sign into Facebook, and there was always a friend online that I could talk to 24 hours a day. That was truly life-saving. So I will never, ever speak badly about social media because it quite honestly saved my life.
You've talked extensively about the idea that you must love your enemy. How do you do that when there's an organized, impassioned vitriol being hurled at you and your community every day?
One of the things I hold on to is what Jesus said on the cross, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." I truly do carry that with me wherever I go, and that in and of itself gets me through a whole heck of a lot.
There are welcoming Episcopalian dioceses in other places. Why did you stay?
At this point, I feel a real calling to have a ministry here. Really, over the past year, year and a half, I've been more and more involved in advocacy and activism here in the state. I have gotten involved in a number of organizations like Arkansas Transgender Equality Coalition, which is a trans organization that encompasses the entire state, working for trans folks. I'm also involved in Pride Corps here in Little Rock, which is a youth center for LGBT folks and their teens and young adulthood. I have found that I am called to be here because there is so much work to do here, and we're beginning to see the tide kind of change, and there's some energy and movement in the right direction here, and I want to be a part of that.
This is Abby Dees, and I've been talking with the Reverend Gwen Fry about her experience coming out trans in the pulpit. Is that a good way of saying it?
Perfect.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Wenzel Jones, Sarah Sweeney, and Abby Dees contributed program material, with double thanks to Steve Pride and to Mark Miracle of Pacifica Radio News. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations like WMPG in Portland, Maine, and to you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at Post Office Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on GaySA Radio, Pretoria, South Africa, WRUW Cleveland, Ohio, KEOS College Station, Texas, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Alan Watts, the philosopher and comparative religion scholar, was one of the foremost interpreters of Eastern thought and philosophy for audiences in the U.S. The author of more than two dozen books, Watts also happened to be a programmer at KPFA in Berkeley for 20 years, beginning in 1953. Today, the last day that we come to you to ask for your support for specifically Against the Grain during this KPFA's spring fund drive, we present portions of two talks that are part of the Alan Watts Library Collection. It's a compilation of 28 hours worth of talks that Alan Watts gave over the course of two decades. Later this hour, we'll present a talk called Insight and Ecstasy. But we begin with portions of a presentation by Watts on the fundamentals of Buddhism. And by the way, the sprawling, comprehensive 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection is your thank you gift for a one-year, $15 per month pledge to listener-supported. We can't do it without people like you because we resolutely don't take corporations or underwriters' money, KPFA. The phone number to call anytime this hour is 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-439-5732 or 1-800-439-KPFA. Let's turn now to excerpts from a presentation by Alan Watts called Fundamentals of Buddhism. When he refers, by the way, to Gautama, he's referring to the 6th century BC Indian figure whom we identify as the Buddha. We take up Watts's talk as he's discussing a certain kind of freedom.
Freedom from an emotional habit, the habit of grasping at one's own life, at seeking for continuity. And you see, the idea of continuity in Buddhist philosophy is that we desire continuity in order to perpetuate our past. In our past, in other words, we have accumulated various things: experiences, material goods, knowledge, virtues, power, so on. And the desire for continuity is the desire for the perpetuation of a past self or string of selves with which we identify ourselves. And Buddhist insight involves the recognition that the past is perpetually vanishing. There really is no past to continue, and therefore to cling to it, to identify oneself with it, is to perpetuate an illusion resulting in incessant frustration. Now, Gautama made it very easy to summarize his teaching. He was really quite an adept in what we call mnemonics, in putting things in simple form so that they could easily be remembered. And he summed up the whole of his doctrine in what is called the Fourfold Noble Truths. And it's based on an old medical formula. In ancient India, as in almost all ancient cultures, every activity was ceremonialized. And when a physician came to pay his call, he gave his diagnosis in a ceremonial way. He made four pronouncements. The first pronouncement was the name of the disease. The second, the cause of the disease. The third, the curability of the disease. Can it be cured? Yes or no? And if it can be cured, the fourth pronouncement is the giving of the prescription. And that's exactly the form of Gautama's summary of his doctrine. He said, in other words, the first principle is that mankind, and indeed all forms of life, suffer from a disease, which is called in Sanskrit dukkha. And the most general translation of that word is suffering. Dukkha means suffering in all its forms: moral, physical, spiritual. But Western interpreters of Buddhism have sometimes represented him as saying that life is suffering, period. In other words, of enunciating a highly pessimistic and world-hating doctrine that to be alive is to suffer, and that, in other words, the amount of joy, of positive pleasure in life is, after all, so negligible that the game is not worth the candle. Now, if one studies the method of teaching of sages in ancient India, you have to realize that one of their fundamental pedagogical gambits is to arrive at the point of view they wish to inculcate by a zigzag method. When we walk, you know, we put down maybe first the left foot, then we shift to the right foot, then the left foot, then the right foot. And in this way, we go along, neither to the left nor to the right, but straight ahead. And you find, too, that in thought, that the human mind tends to go from position to position, but it always, when it settles on any fixed position, we can always point out that that position is an extreme. For example, in scholastic philosophy in the Middle Ages, when St. Thomas Aquinas fastened on the idea that God is fundamentally ends or being, a Buddhist philosopher would point out that he had settled upon an extreme that has an opposite, non-being, and that therefore his position needs to be corrected by the opposite position. Somebody else should get up and say, no, no, God is not being, God is non-being. And from this facing of opposites with each other, we arrive at what Buddhism is sometimes called the middle way. Doesn't mean the compromise position. The middle way is the doctrine of relativity, of showing that all positions or experiences which we can formulate must always be perceived or known by contrast with their opposites. So in other words, Buddha's doctrine that life is fundamentally dukkha or suffering is an antithesis directed towards those people who believe that the object of life is to attain sukha or sweetness, pleasure. He is saying, in other words, you cannot experience pleasure except in reference to non-pleasure. And therefore, the more you pursue pleasure, the more non-pleasure will arise to frustrate you. The more you pursue permanence, the more you will feel the impermanence of things. And so it is, for after all, when we are bent on enjoying ourselves, we become at that very moment curiously aware of how rapidly time is slipping by. When, on the other hand, we are not enjoying ourselves, we become curiously aware of how time is dragging. So then, dukkha, arising from an exaggerated pursuit of sukha, its opposite, becomes the basic characteristic of life. And he goes on to say, in his second principle, that the cause of this is trishna or grasping, sometimes translated desire, and indeed I believe the word trishna does underlie etymologically the English word thirst. But trishna is not quite desire. For example, one's appetite. When you're haven't eaten for some time and you get hungry, this is not trishna. It's a perfectly natural occurrence. Trishna is based in turn on avidya, which means unwisdom or simply lack of insight, lack of consciousness, lack of, well, a special sense of ignorance, not the ordinary sense of ignorance of not being informed, but ignorance. Action based on ignoring something. And ignorance is not realizing the relativity of experiences, not realizing the inseparability of pleasure and pain, existence and non-existence, life and death, up and down, good and bad. So that as a result of such ignorance or unwisdom, people try to separate these opposites from each other. to corral, to gain the good ones, and to exclude and annihilate the bad ones. And as a result of that, because these opposites exist mutually, they go round in circles. And that mutual existence of these opposites is really, it seems to me, the basic meaning of the doctrine of karma, which is involved in Buddhism, the doctrine of conditioned action, which Buddha epitomized in the phrase, this arises, that becomes. In other words, without this on the one hand, or this on the one hand always implies that on the other, good on the one hand implies bad on the other, and so on and so forth. And so, if a person becomes involved in karma, involved in conditioned action, leading to a vicious circle, if he is ignorant of the interdependence of all states of experience. So then the third truth, the cure of this dukkha or suffering, is the truth about nirvana. Nirvana is the most grossly mistranslated word in all foreign languages, probably. Because we are early scholars of Buddhism translated it as annihilation, and nowadays nirvana means a state of being doped up to most people. It's popularly used as being in ecstasy or in a kind of dreamy bliss. And nirvana doesn't mean that at all. It's a state of being very, very wide awake, a state of being completely aware. But the etymology of the word is disputed. There are several etymologies that you can offer, and so I just choose the one I like. And that is to blow out. As when, having tried to hold one's breath, you discover that you can't hold it. You lose your breath by holding it. Therefore, you expire, you despirate. And so you heave a sigh of relief. And so nirvana is the sigh of relief, the expiration or despiration. In other words, the giving up of the attempt to clutch at life, to hold it in a fixed form, to resist change, to separate the good side of things from the bad side and annihilate the bad side. It is the giving up of that fundamentally contradictory, self-contradictory, kind of conduct. And so then in the fourth truth, there is set out the Noble Eightfold Path, Buddha's prescription for dukkha. And the Noble Eightfold Path is really in three divisions, one of which concerns itself with understanding, might almost say intellectual understanding of the doctrine. The one is concerned with conduct, and the third part of it is concerned with state of consciousness or meditation. Now, to summarize them briefly, the first stages of the path, such as a right view, or I prefer to translate the word samyak, not so much as right, but as perfect in the Greek sense of telos or complete. And thus, to have a complete view is a view which does not take sides, which takes the middle path, which in other words does not go off to extremes, and so on. The part of the Eightfold Path that is concerned with conduct. Buddhism is often represented as having a very exalted ethical system, and this is true in a way it does. But also one must recognize that the difference between Buddhism and Christianity, as at any rate as Christianity is ordinarily taught, is that these ethical ideas are not commandments. They are really forms of expedient conduct. The Buddha counseled his followers to take upon themselves certain obligations, say of not killing, of not stealing, of not exploiting the senses, of not getting drunk or intoxicated with poisons, not lying. Not because these were against the will of God or against the fundamental laws of the universe, but because they are inexpedient forms of conduct for a person who wants to wake up, After all, if you get thoroughly doped up, you're not liable to be very wide awake. And then, finally, the end of the path, the last stages of it, are concerned with one state of consciousness, with the process of what is sometimes called meditation, or of bringing one's mind to its maximum awareness through clear recollection, and then finally the attainment of what is called samadhi, which means integrated consciousness. Consciousness no longer under the influence of avidya, no longer bamboozled and fooled by the apparent separateness of things which are really inseparably interlinked. And thus samadhi could be called integrated, a unified consciousness in which it is seen that the subject, the knower, is inseparable from the object, the known, that man is inseparable from the totality of life, and so on and so forth. So that samadhi at the end of the Eightfold Path might be described as being the entry to, or realization, the making real of, the state of nirvana, which constitutes in turn being a Buddha.
Alan Watts speaking there, the philosopher, the lecturer, the author, the legendary KPFA broadcaster, the influential interpreter of Eastern thought and philosophy, the scholar of comparative religion, the teacher of comparative philosophy and psychology, the writer of more than 25 books. His books have been translated into at least 11 languages. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain. This is the last hour that I come to you asking for your support for this program, Against the Grain, on and this fund drive, this KPFA Spring Fund Drive. And we've got a fantastic set of thank you gifts for you today. One of them is the Alan Watts Library Collection, which is not 1 hour of Alan Watts, or 5 hours, or 10 hours, or 20 hours, but 28 hours of talks that Alan Watts gave on KPFA and in the community for just a $15 a month pledge to KPFA per month for 12 months. That comes out to $180. You can pay it, you know, in $180. You can break it down into installments at $15 a month. And the phone number to call to get a fantastic thank you gift and to get all these insights into Buddhism and into these Buddhist concepts and Buddhist ideas and ways of thinking from the East, from the Far East, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. It's very easy to remember as 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-439-KPFA. You can also donate securely online at kpfa.org. And as I might have expected during my last hour with you, during Against the Grain, this drive, I've been given a match of $300 from Maria in San Francisco. Thank you, Maria. And that means in the next 4 minutes, and then we'll go right back to more of Alan Watts giving a very interesting talk on insight and ecstasy. In the next 4 minutes, we are all challenged to come up with $300 to support this program and to support KPFA. We've also got a wonderful combo pack. So if you want the 28 hours of Alan Watts on the Alan Watts Library Collection, you can call in and get it for a $180 one-year pledge to KPFA, $15 per month. But if you want to give a dollar a day, if you can afford to give a dollar a day for a year, over a year to KPFA, then we will offer you, we can offer you this 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection plus a 3-DVD set of films about Alan Watts. It's called Why Not Now? Well, actually, Why Not Now is one of the films. It's a documentary on the life and works of Alan Watts, made by his son, Mark Watts. The second DVD is a bonus disc of video material that they could not fit into the film. And the third DVD is called The Animated Alan Watts. So it is an animated presentation of Alan Watts's ideas and insights into Eastern thought, into Buddhism. all of that, those three DVDs plus the Alan Watts Library Collection, is yours for $1 a day to KPFA. That is a steep discount from what we would have, well, you know, in fact, just the $15 a month pledge for the 28 hours of Alan Watts is a steep discount. But that is an extra steep discount for those of you who want to give $1 a day to KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can pledge online at kpfa.org. Alan Watts attracted a huge following while he was alive, and for good reason. He speaks clearly, he speaks thoughtfully, he speaks deeply, he speaks eloquently, and he was considered one of the major figures who brought Eastern philosophy and thought to the West. He moved to the U.S. in 1939 from the U.K., where in the U.S. he became famous as a leader of the counterculture, and specifically the Bay Area counterculture in the 1960s. And his programs consisted of lectures, of substantive talks by Alan Watts. We are offering you 28 hours of Alan Watts on three MP3 CDs. And you know how much just one MP3 CD can hold. So it doesn't even fit into one. It's three MP3 CDs consists of, brings you 28 hours of Alan Watts on this library collection, just a $180 one-year pledge to KPFA, and it's doubled. It's doubled right now by Maria in San Francisco. So we get $360 if you call and pledge now. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Give us a call. Let us know you care about and depend on KPFA, and that you want this fantastic thank you gift. You can pledge at any level, right? The thank you gifts are legion. You can call and talk to a friendly phone volunteer. There are thank you gifts at the $75 level, at the $100 level, at the $180 level, which one of them is, of course, the 28 hours of Alan Watts. But the important thing is to make that call and to say yes to this kind of deep insight, this kind of deep philosophical insight, that you want more of this on KPFA, and you are telling us with your call that you want more. So we did make that match. Thank you to everybody who called or pledged online at kpfa.org. Again, the number is 1-800-439-5732. And now I want to return to another talk in this 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection. It's called Insight and Ecstasy.
I think it's terribly important to understand that if you're interested in Eastern philosophy, if you're studying Hinduism or Buddhism or something of that kind, with the object of attaining ecstasy, that this is a complete misunderstanding. There must really be a distinction between ecstasy, that is to say, the thrill, the kick, the delight, the joy of a mystical experience, and the experience itself. Because the experience itself may or may not have ecstasy as a consequence. That is simply a byproduct. The experience itself is always a matter of insight. And the insight, the understanding of the way things are, what you are, what life is, may indeed produce ecstasy, because sometimes this understanding is an enormous relief. And that is the reason when one has been battling, say, with some tremendous problem and suddenly finds the whole thing disappears, when you've been terrified at something or anxious about something and all the grounds for anxiety vanish, then very naturally you feel enormously happy and joyous. And also, I would add that the kind of insight which is the essence or the core of this sort of experience has a way of making the ordinary everyday world seem extraordinarily beautiful. And that again is a byproduct. Whereas things before seemed rather dim and oppressive. You know how even on a fine day, if you're feeling sad or depressed, the actual landscape somehow looks dimmer. Whereas, on the other hand, if you are feeling wonderful, the landscape itself looks wonderful. And so, in the same way, if one has had certain insights which bring about an extraordinary sense of relief from the oppression of certain problems, then very naturally, everything in the world looks a lot better. And you could even go so far as to say it seems transfused with a divine light. Speaking first of all from, say, a Buddhist standpoint, there's no doubt in my mind that the insight in question that constitutes what is called Satori in Zen, or in more general Buddhism, Bodhi, which means awakening, this is not the vision of something like a God underlying the world. Although Buddhist philosophy occasionally uses expressions like the great void, or suchness, or the Dharmakaya, the absolute reality, and thus gives the impression that it has a belief in some sort of continuum underlying the world, in rather the same way that water is a continuum in which fish move and air is the continuum in which men move. There are many, many texts in the literature of Mahayana Buddhism which explicitly deny that this is the meaning. It would be much more correct to describe what they call the void as a state of complete mental clarity, in which one ceases entirely to be bothered by false problems. Because the basic thesis of Buddhist philosophy is that the sufferings, the agonies of mankind, especially the psychological ones, derive almost entirely from false problems, from bothering our heads over questions that are not real questions at all. And when these problems are solved, when it is seen that we were asking the wrong question, then one gets this astonishing sensation of seeing that problems exist only, as it were, in a mental sphere. They exist as a result of thought, whereas the world which is not thought, the world which simply is entirely free from problems. Now, of course, that is something extraordinarily contrary to our general common sense. We think the physical world is full of problems, and we have thought as a valuable instrument to enable us to solve them. And it's true, thought is a valuable instrument. But valuable, we might ask, for whom? Valuable for those who can use it, but not so valuable for those who are used by it, those who, in other words, are hoodwinked by thinking into problems which would not exist otherwise, and which really have no reason to exist. Now let us take, as a simple example, the common philosophical problem with which we've been obsessed in the West for centuries. The problems which are called ontology, or the study of being, and the problems of epistemology, the study of knowledge. These problems very largely have to do with the inquiry as to who or what I am, that's epistemology, and who or what the whole universe is, that is ontology. And they derive from what appears to be the common sense feeling that processes of any kind, actions of any kind, have to have behind them an agent. In other words, if we know, we ask very naturally the question, who or what knows? If we see a movement or an action, we ask who or what moves? And underlying the whole history of scientific inquiry until quite recent times, there has been the urge to know what ultimately underlies the process of the universe. And you see, this has its roots in the historic division of life into two categories. The category of substance and that of function. We always seem to feel that wherever we see activity, operation, movement, energy, that there must be something which does it. Now, many of you who've read the writings of that extraordinarily interesting American linguist, Benjamin Lee Whorf, will remember how he pointed out the arbitrariness of this distinction between events and things. How, for example, he showed that very often in our language, phenomena which are clearly events are masquerading in words which seem to suggest that they are things. And he made some most interesting discussions in his book, Language, Thought, and Reality, about what we really mean by the distinction between these two classes, to which we assign in our language nouns for things and verbs for events. But of course, in recent philosophy, it's become more and more clear to us that we can use verb language, or process language, or operational language, to discuss almost anything we want. Any natural phenomenon can be described as doing rather than being. And in general, this is a very useful way of talking about things. We, in other words, dispense with an unnecessary duality in language, an unnecessary distinction between process and entity. And what appear to be entities can always be described in terms of perhaps a slower type of process than the things we've normally described by verbs. And if we consider this, then, and start talking about everything that happens in process language, in operational language, we suddenly see that things or entities, that is to say, the who or what that does something, the agent behind the act, these things completely disappear. A famous instance which Whorf gave of this was in the Hopi language, that when we say a light flashed, the Hopis just say flashed. And he pointed out that's much more accurate because the flashing is, of course, the light. But in this way, we have created a thing behind the act, which is a sort of ghost. And the objective of Buddhist discipline is, as one old Zen master put it, to beat the ghosts out of you. Now, in the same way, you see, when we know something or we act, it's a very basic common sense supposition that we are the agent behind the actor. That, in other words, behind thought there's a thinker, behind experience an experiencer, behind perception, a perceiver. And we are, all of us, you see, tremendously concerned with this image, the doer, the agent, which has become our image of ourselves. You might call it our self-image, if you speak in a psychological jargon. And this is the thing we're all concerned about. Its future, its history, its destiny, what's going to become of it, and so on and so forth. But through clarity, it can turn out that this thing that we fancy ourselves to be simply is a figure of thought or a figure of speech and is not there at all. And the only reason why this makes us feel astounded and bothered and unbelieving is the momentum of a habit of thought. Although it may become sort of intellectually clear to us that this is so, we still have deep in us the habit of attributing all actions to an agent. And it's difficult for us to realize, to become really clear, that this is only figurative. That there is no, as it were, distinct order of being that is the doer as distinct from the deed. So one is then confronted, when one realizes this vividly, with the astonishing realization that one is not this entity that one supposed oneself to be, that one is not being pushed around by laws of physical necessity. The difficulty is, you see, that thought is, as it were, a system of symbols that stands apart from life and represents it, just as words stand apart from things and represent them. But they don't really stand apart from them. Words are noises, and thoughts are sensations or images. And they only apparently stand apart. Well, as we identify ourselves to so large an extent with our thinking process, we naturally come to feel that we, too, stand apart from life. And as a result of this, we have the customary feeling that when we are not distracted with thought, we have a curious feeling of emptiness, of having no time, of being very, well, just being evaporating histories. But of course, if you stand apart from life, you're dead. But we don't really stand apart, but we think we do. And therefore, when one recovers from that illusion, and the sense of one's separateness, of one's being a thing, an agent, simply disappears. It's not a kind of fatalistic situation, because the feeling of fatalism is that one is the agent, but one is being pushed around. And so this disappearance and this loss of the sense of separation between the subject and the object, the thinker and thought, and in turn thought and life, could be called, you see, a sense of unity, to which one might, if one were a Christian, give the sense of a union with God. But a Buddhist doesn't give it that sense. And since it involves release from the problem of oneself, the lifting of a colossal burden from one's shoulders, there may ensue ecstasy. But the ecstasy itself has nothing to do with it. It's simply a byproduct of the insight of living in a physical world that is totally free from most of the thought problems, if not all the thought problems, about which we continuously beat our bodies and our brains.
Beating our bodies and our brains. I can certainly relate to beating my brain and having all these thoughts and creating all these problems for myself that Alan Watts would probably tell me are false problems. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on listener-supported KPFA. You've been listening to two talks, portions of two talks given by Alan Watts, the philosopher, the author, the writer of more than 25 books. He taught comparative philosophy. He held a master's degree in theology. He was a scholar of comparative religion and psychology. He hosted a KPFA radio program for 20 years, beginning in 1953. And we have this wonderful thank you gift, two wonderful thank you gifts for you this hour, which are the 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection. Yes, 28 hours of insights into Eastern thought and Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist concepts like nirvana and samadhi and dukkha, and all these words that are so often misrepresented or simplified in Western discourse. 28 hours of Alan Watts, $15 a month pledge over 12 months. Yes, you can put it on installments. It comes out to $180. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. You've been given a little bit of a sip of Alan Watts, and maybe you want the gulp. Maybe you want the big drink. Maybe you want all the insights that you can handle. And You can listen to this in easily digestible chunks, maybe half an hour at a time. That would take you 56 days to go through more than almost 2 months worth of Alan Watts at half an hour at a time, or maybe 15 minutes at a time, and then you can think about what you've heard and process it. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And also, we have this magnificent Alan Watts discounted combo pack, which is for a dollar a day pledge to KPFA, $365 all at once, if you like. You get not just the Alan Watts library collection of 28 hours of this man's insights into Eastern thought, but also three documentary films about Alan Watts, one by his son Mark Watts on the life and work and ideas and perspectives of Alan Watts. Secondly, the bonus disc of video material they couldn't fit in the film. And third, the animated Alan Watts. And I believe the South Park animators, I know the South Park animators had something to do with the animated Alan Watts. That's a dollar a day to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. KPFA.org. And for those of you who are wondering what else is on this 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection, which is a $180 one-year pledge to KPFA, and folks, we only have 3 days left, less than 3 days left in our KPFA Spring Fund Drive. We're far behind. Well, we're significantly behind, so an avalanche of support this hour would do wonders, and it would make me feel like we are going out with a bang, so to speak, because this is the last, again, the last hour, in fact, the last 13 minutes that I come to you asking for your specific support for Against the Grain, this fund drive, 1-800-439-5732. Well, I'm going to read you some of the titles of these talks on this 28-hour insight-packed, high-value Alan Watts Library collection on three MP3 CDs. Fundamentals of Eastern Philosophy, Fundamentals of Buddhism, Discussion of Buddhist Mysticism, The Spiritual Odyssey of Aldous Huxley, that's interesting, Conscience and Concentration, The Art of Psychoanalysis, there's a tribute to C.G. Jung, The Symbolic and the Real, there's a memorial tribute to Alan Watts in here, Philosophy as Music, Art, Philosophy, and Self-Improvement, Levels of Magnification, The Study of Asia, The Constitution of Nature, Reconciliation of Opposites, Truth and Relativity, Paul Tillich on the Eternal Now, Return of the Forest. There is so much in this 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection, and I want to share it with you. And maybe you think the KPFA in this program specifically shares a lot with you over the course of a year. Maybe you haven't given in 2 years or 5 years, in which case giving $180 is even more valuable in a sense, because then you're getting away with, you know, if it's 10 years and you give $180 and you really, it's like you've been giving $18 per year over the last 10 years. So think about the value that KPFA gets you, gives you, provides you, and think about what you want to give in return at this critical time, because we've been given the last match of the last Against the Grain program, and it is $800 from Benjamin and Julian in Santa Rosa, the last Against the Grain program, this fund drive, I should say, hopefully. $800 from Benjamin and Julian. So this is our last match, and we've got 11 minutes to make it, and that means every dollar you give is doubled by Benjamin and Julian. It's a conditional pledge from them. And by the way, if you're sitting on a pot of money and you'd like to call in, and a number of people have called in, a future match, a match that can be given out in the last 2.5 days of this KPFA's Spring Fund Drive to motivate other people to call in. But in the meantime, your dollars are doubled by Benjamin and Julian. I want to thank so far Rosendo Aguilar from Missoula, Montana. Oh, love to hear from Montana. I've always wanted to go to Bozeman, by the way, ever since I read another Buddhist-inflected tome called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. William Prince from Inverness called in. Thank you so much, William. Ann DeRusa from El Cerrito, thank you. Mike Stephen from Tarabella. I don't know where that is, but it sounds lovely. Thank you so much, Mike. Ray Carter from Oakland called in. Thank you. Kim Leihun or Leijon from Oakland, thank you so much. Kim, Debbie Reed in San Jose, Thank you so much. Call 1-800-439-5732 or 1-800-439-KPFA and join Bernard LeDuc calling in from Half Moon Bay. Oh, there's a lovely place. Jacqueline or Jackie Moschella or Moschella from Fremont. Maybe that's Fremont, but in any case, thank you so much. Marguerite Cholakian from Hillsboro, thanks so much. And Carolyn Kane from San Francisco, among the people who are calling in, many of them are requesting the Alan Watts Library Collection. You can't get much more value than that. So, you know, you're sort of like a, you know, you want the most value. Whenever you go shop, you use the coupons, you like the discounts. Well, here there's 28 hours of Alan Watts, and it's just a $180 or $15 a month pledge. It's less than a movie and a popcorn per month, and you don't get like a two-hour or one-hour or 90-minute film every month. You get 28 hours of Alan Watts over the course of 1 year. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Again, the dollar a day pledge to KPFA gets you the Alan Watts Library Collection, all 28 hours of it, plus the three DVD set of films about Alan Watts, Why Not Now, made by his son Mark Watts, and we've had him on this program before. He's an amazing guy himself. This is about the big issues, the nature of reality, the meaning of life, the pursuit of happiness, how our minds work, the comparative emphases of Eastern and Western philosophies, the interconnectedness of things. Alan Watts is a great storyteller, as you might have known. He's a very deep thinker, and I know we've got a lot of deep thinkers out there, a lot of deep-thinking listeners interested in the big questions, and this is your way to show us that you care and that you want some amazing insights in return for your hard-earned money. I've taken classes in Buddhism. I've taken classes on Taoism, and it is utterly fascinating, but it is also there are so many misconceptions around a lot of this Eastern thought, and Alan Watts took the time to study, to practice, to learn, and he wrote more than 25 books. His books have been translated into at least 11 languages. He was fundamentally interested in human nature, in human relationships, in environmental processes, and this is a wonderful thing for yourself, and then you could give it to somebody else. You could take this thank you gift and thank somebody else with that gift. 1-800-439-5732. Every dollar you give is doubled. We have got less than 7 minutes left to make this match of $800. And something that I really love about Alan Watts and I love about Buddhism is that it's about freedom. It's fundamentally about freedom, and it's part, and a lot of that freedom comes is in relation to habit. It's freedom from habit. It's freedom from our reflexive responses, whether those responses or reactions to the world involve clinging or grasping or attaching to things. We all have certain reflexive responses and judgments to things, and they often, the vast majority of time, at least for me, they don't help me. They're not productive for me. They don't assist me in achieving more meaning and more clarity and more equanimity. They create false problems for me, and I grind on them. I grind on these thoughts and ideas that I have that are reflexive, that just come to me. And what Buddhism and what Alan Watts is about is freeing us from these habits, these ways of thinking that are so ingrained that they are natural now, but no one's told us, but now maybe Alan Watts is coming to tell us that there is another way of looking and seeing and being and perceiving of the past and the present and the future that can really change our attitudes, change our behavior, change our fundamental outlook. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. $180 pledge gets you 28 hours of Alan Watts. We just scratched the surface of the Alan Watts library collection today. $15 a month. You can put it on installments, and you don't have to pay a lot of those installments before you get this thank you gift coming your way. 1-800-439-5732, a dollar a day. Gets you the three DVD set, Why Not Now, about Alan Watts, plus the Alan Watts Library Collection. 1-800-439-KPFA. Again, you can donate online at kpfa.org. And what I wanted to say was, often I think, at least I think, about how to bring beauty and meaning into my life. How to bring beauty and meaning into my life apart from the chaos and the frenetic busyness and all the tasks and all the worries and all the anxieties and all the frustrations. How do we bring beauty and meaning into our lives? In our materialistic culture, the answer is often buy or obtain beautiful things. But Buddhist thought, the Buddha said something very, very different. Learn about it. Learn about how so much of that beauty and so much of that meaning, and perhaps all of it, wasn't that a revolutionary thought? Maybe all of that beauty and all of that meaning that we crave so deeply for our souls, for our sustenance, for our peace of mind, can come from within. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, and let me and Sasha know that philosophy matters, that you care about Eastern insights, you care about alternative insights, you care about insights from other traditions, you care about critical thought, you care about ways of dissecting, you care about the dissection of what have become natural thoughts and ideas to us in the West, and that you care about the critical perspectives we bring to the air three times a week. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. $180 or $15 a month. And, I'm not rich, but $15 a month out of my bank account, I would not notice. I'm not rich. You can't get rich here working at KPFA, but $15 a month out of my bank account wouldn't mean much to me. And if it doesn't mean much to you and you want this amazing 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection, give us a call, not in 5 minutes, not in 10 minutes, but right now. Right now, give us a call. Right now means you care. Right now means you get this information. Right now means you're standing up. And the theme of this drive that I haven't emphasized enough is do the right thing. You're doing the right thing. You're becoming part of something. You are contributing part of who you are and part of what you've made and what you've earned over time. You are doing something with your money that, in my opinion, you can feel very proud of and you can feel very gratified about. And you can feel that this is a meaningful act. It's a meaningful act that leads to a lot of meaning and a lot of insight from Alan Watts in the form of this 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. It's a magical call, and it's about, among other things, continuing to bring meaning into your life, not just via Alan Watts, but via KPFA. There's a lot in this 28-hour collection about how we are socialized, what we are taught to do and to be, and whether any of this is helpful or harmful. Do we do the right thing in relation to our children? Do we do them justice? Joseph Campbell, the great scholar of mythology and religion and philosophy, he praised Alan Watts' efforts to convey the history and the development of Eastern thought. Much of Alan Watts is about going above and beyond the herd mentality, the herd morality. And a lot of that herd mentality it comes from Western thought. It comes from Enlightenment thinking. And I'm not slamming all of Western thought, and neither is Alan Watts. But there's a reason that so many people are interested in Eastern thought and philosophy. Yeah.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.